Had I apologized? Well, never mind. Close enough. Maybe. Then I'm sorry about that, too, I said. I owe you an apology myself, she said. So, I guess this one's a wash. You, what do you have to apologize for? Tom Riley called, just 2 days ago. He's back on his meds. He's going to, I quote, see someone again, by which I assume he means a shrink. And he called to thank me for saving his life. Have you ever had someone call and thank you for that? No. Although I'd recently had someone call and thank me for saving his sight, so I kind of knew what she was talking about. It's quite an experience. If not for you, I'd be dead now. Those were his exact words. And I couldn't tell him he had you to thank because it would have sounded crazy. It was as if a tight belt cinching my middle had suddenly been cut away. Sometimes things work out for the best. Sometimes they actually do. That's good, Pam. I've been on to Ilsa about this show of yours. Yes, I... Well, Illy and Lynn both, but when I talked to Ilsa, I turned the conversation toward Tom, and I could tell right away that she doesn't know anything about what went on between the two of us. I was wrong about that, too, and showed a very unpleasant side of myself while I was at it. I realized with alarm that she was crying. Pam, listen. I've shown several unlovely sides of myself to several people since you left me. I didn't leave you, I almost shouted. And it was close. Close enough to make sweat pop out of my forehead. I didn't leave you. You asked for a divorce, you witting quench. What I said was, Pam, that's enough. But it was so hard to believe, even after you called and told me those other things, you know, about my new TV and puffball. I started to ask who Puffball was, then remembered the cat. I'm doing better, though. I've started going to church again. Can you believe that? And a therapist. I see her once a week. She paused, then rushed on. She's good. She says a person can't close the door on the past. She can only make amends and go on. I understood that, but I didn't know how to start making amends to you, Eddie. Pam, you don't owe me any... My therapist says it isn't about what you think, it's about what I think. I see. That sounded a lot like the old Pam, so maybe she'd found the right therapist. And then your friend Wireman called and told me you needed help. And he sent me those pictures. I can't wait to see the actual things. I mean, I knew you had some talent, because you used to draw those little books for Lynn when she was so sick that year. I did. I remembered Melinda's sick year. She'd had one infection after another, culminating in a massive bout of diarrhea, probably brought on by too many antibiotics, that landed her in the hospital for a week. She'd lost 10 pounds that spring. If not for summer vacation and her own grade A intelligence, she would have needed to repeat the second grade. But I couldn't remember drawing any little books. Freddy the Fish, Carla the Crab, Donald the Timid Deer... Donald the Timid Deer rang a very faint bell, way down deep, but... No, I said. Angel thought you should try to get them published, don't you remember? But these, my God, did you know you could do it? No. I started thinking something might be there when I was at the place on Lake Phelan, but it's gone further than I thought it would. I thought of Wireman Looks West and the mouthless, noseless Candy Brown and thought I'd just uttered the understatement of the century. Eddie, will you let me do the rest of the invitations the way I did the sample? I can customize them, make them nice. Pam. Almost Panda again. Pam, I can't ask you to do that. I want to. Yeah? Then, okay. I'll write them and email them to Mr. Wireman. You can check them over before he prints them. He's quite a jewel, your Mr. Wireman. Yes, I said, he is. The two of you really ganged up on me. We did, didn't we? She sounded delighted. You needed it. Only you have to do something for me. What? You have to call the girls, because they're going crazy. Ilsa, in particular. Okay? Okay. And Pam. What, hun? I'm sure she said that without thinking, without knowing how it could cut. Ah, well, She probably felt the same way when she heard my pet name for her coming up from Florida, growing colder with every mile it sped north. "Thanks," I said. "Totally welcome." It was only 10:45 when we said goodbye and hung up. Time never went faster that winter than it did during my evenings in Little Pink. Standing at my easel, I'd wonder how the colors in the west could possibly fade so fast. And it never went slower than it did that morning when I made the phone calls I'd been putting off. I swallowed them one after the other, like medicine. I looked at the cordless sitting in my lap. "Fuck you, phone," I said and started dialing again. 5.
Scoto Gallery, this is Alice.
A cheery voice I'd come to know well over the last 10 days. "Hi, Alice, it's Edgar Fremantle."
"Yes, Edgar?"
Cheery became cautious. Had that cautious note been there before? Had I just ignored it? I said, "If you have a couple of minutes, I wonder if we could talk about ordering the slides at the lecture."
"Yes, Edgar, we certainly could."
The relief was palpable. It made me feel like a hero. Of course, it also made me feel like a rat. "Have you got a pad handy?"
"You bet your tail feathers."
"Okay, basically, we're going to want them in chronological order."
"But I don't know the chronology. I've been trying to tell you that..."
"I know, and I'm going to give it to you now. But listen, Alice, the first slide won't be chronological. The first should be of roses grow from shells. Have you got that?"
"Roses grow from shells. I've got it."
For only the second time since meeting me, Alice sounded genuinely happy that we were talking. "Now, the pencil sketches," I said. We talked for the next half an hour. 6.
"Oui, allô?"
For a moment I said nothing. The French threw me a little. The fact that it was a young man's voice threw me more.
"Allô? Allô?"
Impatient now.
"Qui est à l'appareil?"
Maybe I have the wrong number," I said, feeling not just like an asshole, but a monolingual American asshole. I was trying to reach Melinda Fremantle.
"D'accord, you have the right number."
Then off a little.
"Melinda, c'est ton papa, je crois, chérie."
The phone went down with a clunk. I had a momentary image, very clear, very politically incorrect, and very likely brought on by Pam's mention of the cartoon books I'd once drawn for a little sick girl, of a large talking skunk in a beret. Monsieur Pepe Le Pew, strutting around my daughter's pension, if that was the word for a bed-sitter-type apartment in Paris, with wavy aroma lines rising from his white striped back. Then Melinda was there, sounding uncharacteristically flustered.
"Dad? Daddy? Is everything all right?"
"Everything's fine," I said.
"Is that your roommate?"
It was a joke, but I realized from her uncharacteristic silence that I had unwittingly hit the nail on the head. "It's not a big deal, Linny. I was just goofing with me, right?" It was impossible to tell if she was amused or exasperated. The connection was good, but not that good.
"He is, actually."
The subtext of that one to come through loud and clear.
"Want to make something of it?"
I most assuredly did not want to make something of it. "Well, I'm glad you made a friend. Does he wear a beret?" To my immense relief, she laughed. With Lynn, it was impossible to tell which way a joke was going to go, because her sense of humor was as unreliable as an April afternoon. She called,
"Rick, mon papa,"
something I didn't catch then.
"Si tu portes un beret."
There was a faint male laughter. "Ah, Edgar," I thought. "Even overseas, you lay him in the aisles, you père fou."
"Daddy, are you all right?"
"Fine. How's your strep?"
"All better, thanks."
"I just got off the phone with your mother. You're going to get an official invitation to this show I'm having. But she says you'll come, and I'm thrilled."
"You're thrilled? Mom sent me some of the pictures, and I can't wait. When did you learn to do that?"
This seemed to be the question of the hour.
"Down here, they're amazing. Are the others as good?"
"You'll have to come and see for yourself."
"Could Rick come?
Does he have a passport?"
"Yes."
"Will he promise not to poke the fun at your old man?"
He's very respectful of his elders. Then assuming the flights aren't sold out, and you don't mind sleeping two to a room, I assume that's not a problem, then of course he can come. She squealed so loudly it hurt my ear, but I didn't take the telephone away. It had been a long time since I'd said or done anything to make Linny Fremantle squeal like that. Thank you, Daddy. That's great. It'll be nice to meet Rick. Maybe I'll steal his beret. I'm an artist now, after all. I'll tell him you said that. Her voice changed. Have you talked to Ilse yet? No, why? When you do, don't say anything about Rick coming, okay? Let me do that. I hadn't planned to. Because she and Carson, she said she told you about him. She did. Well, I'm pretty sure there's a problem there. Illy says she's thinking things over. That's a direct quote. Rick's not surprised. He says you should never trust a person who prays in public. All I know is she sounds a lot more grown up than my baby sister used to. Same goes for you, Lynn, I thought. I had a momentary image of how she'd looked at 7, when she'd been so sick Pam and I both thought she might die on us, although we never said so aloud. Back then, Melinda had been all big dark eyes, pale cheeks, and lank hair. Once I remember thinking, skull on a stick, and hating myself for the thought, and hating myself more for knowing in the deep reaches of my heart that if one of them had to sicken that way, I was glad it had been her. I always tried to believe that I loved both my daughters with the same weight and intensity, but it wasn't true. Maybe it is for some parents. I think it was for Pam, but it never was for me. And did Melinda know? Of course she did. Are you taking care of yourself? I asked her. Yes, Daddy. I could almost see her rolling her eyes. Continue to do so, and get here safe. Daddy? A pause. I love you. I smiled. How many bunches? 1,000,001 for under your pillow, she said, as if humoring a child. That was all right. I sat there for a little while, looking out at the water, rubbing absently at my eyes. Then made what I hoped would be the day's last call. 7. It was noon by then, and I didn't really expect to get her. I thought she'd be out eating lunch with friends. Only like Pam, she answered on the first ring. Her hello was oddly cautious, and I had a sudden clear intuition. She thought I was Carson Jones, calling either to beg for another chance or to explain yet again. That was a hunch I never verified, but then I never had to. Some things you simply know are true. Hey, if so, girl, what you doing? Her voice brightened immediately. Daddy! How are you, hon? I'm fine, Daddy, but not as fine as you. Did I tell you they were good? I mean, did I tell you, or what? You told me, I said, grinning in spite of myself. She might have sounded older to Lynn, but after that first tentative hello, she sounded to me like the same old Illy, bubbling over like a Coke float. Mom said you were dragging your feet. But she was going to team up with this friend you made down there and get you cranking. I loved it. She sounded just like the old days. She paused to draw breath, and when she spoke again, she didn't sound so giddy. Well, not quite, but it'll do. Know what you mean, Jelly Bean. Daddy, you're so amazing. This is a comeback and a half. How much is all this sugar going to cost me? Millions, she said and laughed. Still planning to drop in on the Hummingbirds tour? I tried to sound just interested, not particularly concerned with my almost 20-year-old daughter's love life. No, she said. I think that's off. Only 5 words, and little ones at that, but in those 5 words I heard the different, older Illy. One who might in the not-so-distant future be at home in a business suit and pantyhose and pumps with practical 3/4 heels. Who might wear her hair tied back at the nape of her neck during the day, and perhaps carry a briefcase down airport concourses, instead of wearing a Gap sack on her back. Not an if-so girl any longer. You could strike any if from this version. The girl as well. The whole thing, or... That remains to be seen. I don't mean to pry, honey. It's just that inquiring dads want to know. Of course they do, but I can't help you this time. All I know right now is that I still love him, or at least I think I do. And I miss him, but he's got to make a choice.
At this point, Pam would have asked, between you and the girl he's been singing with? What I asked was, are you eating? She burst into peals of merry laughter. Answer the question, Illy. Like a damn pig. Then why aren't you out to lunch now?
A bunch of us are going to have a picnic in the park, that's why. Complete with anthro study notes and frisbee. I'm bringing the cheese and French bread, and I'm late.
Okay, as long as you're eating and not brooding in your tent.
Eating well, brooding moderately.
Her voice changed again, became the adult one. The abrupt switches back and forth were disconcerting.
Sometimes I lie awake a little, and then I think of you down there. Do you lie awake?
Sometimes. Not as much now.
Daddy, was marrying Mom a mistake you made, that she made, or was it just an accident?
It wasn't an accident, and it wasn't a mistake. 24 good years, 2 fine daughters, and we're still talking. It wasn't a mistake, Illy.
You wouldn't change it?
People kept asking me that question.
No.
If you could go back, would you? I paused, but not long. Sometimes there's no time to decide what's the best answer. Sometimes you can only give the true answer.
No, honey.
Okay. But I miss you, Dad. I miss you, too.
Sometimes I miss the old times, too, when things were less complicated.
She paused. I could have spoken, wanted to, but kept silent. Sometimes silence is best.
Dad, do people deserve second chances?
I thought of my own second chance, how I had survived an accident that should have killed me. And I was doing more than just hanging out, it seemed. I felt a rush of gratitude. All the time.
Thanks, Daddy. I can't wait to see you.
Back at you. You'll get an official invitation soon.
Okay. I really have to go. Love you.
Love you, too. I sat for a moment with the phone at my ear after she hung up, listening to the nothing. Do the day and let the day do you, I said. Then the dial tone kicked in, and I decided I had one more call to make after all.
8.
This time when Alice O'Coyne came to the phone, she sounded a lot more lively and a lot less cautious. I thought that was a nice change. Alice, we never talked about a name for the show, I said.
I was sort of assuming you meant to call it Roses Grow from Shells, she said. That's good. Very evocative.
It is, I said, looking out to the Florida room and the gulf beyond. The water was a brilliant blue-white plate. I had to squint against the glare. But it's not quite right.
You have one you like better, I take it.
Yes, I think so. I want to call it The View from Duma. What do you think? Her response was immediate.
I think it sings.
So did I.
9.
I had sweat through my Lose It in the Virgin Islands t-shirt in spite of Big Pink's efficient air conditioning, and I was more exhausted than a brisk walk to El Palacio and back left me these days. My ear felt hot and throbby from the telephone. I felt uneasy about Ilsa, the way parents are always uneasy about the problems of their children, I suppose, once they're too old to be called home when it starts to get dark and the baths are being drawn. But I also felt satisfied with the work I'd put in, the way I used to feel after a good day on a hard construction job. I didn't feel particularly hungry, but I made myself slop a few tablespoons of tuna salad onto a lettuce leaf and wash it down with a glass of milk. Whole milk, bad for the heart, good for the bones. I guess that one's a wash, Pam would have said. I turned on the kitchen TV and learned that Candy Brown's wife was suing the city of Sarasota over her husband's death, claiming negligence. Good luck on that one, sweetheart, I thought. The local meteorologist said the hurricane season might start earlier than ever, and the Devil Rays had gotten their low-rent asses kicked by the Red Sox in an exhibition game. Welcome to baseball reality, boys. I considered dessert. I had jello pudding, sometimes known as the last resort of the single man. Ben just put my plate in the sink and limped off to the bedroom for a nap. I considered setting the alarm, then didn't bother. I'd probably only doze. Even if I actually slept, the light would wake me up in an hour or so when it got over to the western side of the house and came angling in the bedroom window. So thinking, I lay down and slept until 6 o'clock that evening. 10. There was no question of supper. I didn't even consider it. Below me, the shells were whispering, paint, paint. I went upstairs to Little Pink like a man in a dream, wearing only my undershorts. I turned on the bone, set girl in ship number 7 against the wall, and put a fresh canvas, not as big as the one I'd used for Wireman Looks West, but big, on my easel. My missing arm was itching, but this no longer bothered me the way it had at first. The truth was, I'd almost come to look forward to it. Shark Puppy was on the radio. Dig. Excellent song. Excellent lyrics. Life is more than love and pleasure. I remember clearly how the whole world seemed to be waiting for me to begin. That was how much power I felt running through me, while the guitars screamed and the shells murmured. I came here to dig for treasure. Treasure, yes. Loot. I painted until the sun was gone and the moon cast its bitter rind of white light over the water, and after that was gone, too. And the next night. And the next. And the next. Girl in ship number 8. If you want to play, you gotta pay. I unbottled. 11. The sight of Dario in a suit and tie with his lush hair tamed and combed straight back from his forehead scared me even more than the murmuring audience that filled Gelbart Auditorium, where the lights had just been turned down to half, except for the spotlight shining down on the lectern standing at center stage, that was. The fact that Dario himself was nervous, going to the podium, he had nearly dropped his note cards, scared me even worse. "Good evening. My name is Dario Nannuzzi," he said. "I am co-curator and chief buyer at the Scotto Gallery on Palm Avenue. More importantly, I have been part of the Sarasota art community for 30 years, and I hope you will excuse my brief descent into what some might call bobbitry when I say there is no finer art community in America." This brought enthusiastic applause from an audience which, as Wireman said later, might know the difference between Monet and Manet, but apparently didn't have a clue that there was a difference between George Babbitt and John Bobbitt. Standing in the wings, suffering through that purgatory, only frightened main speakers experience as their introducers wind their slow and peristaltic courses, I hardly noticed. Dario shifted his top file card to the bottom, once again nearly dropped the whole stack, recovered, and looked out at his audience again. "I hardly know where to begin, but to my relief I need say very little, for true talent seems to blaze up from nowhere and serves as its own introduction." That said, he proceeded to introduce me for the next 10 minutes, as I stood in the wings with my one lousy page of notes clutched in my remaining hand. Names went past like floats in a parade, a few like Edward Hopper and Salvador Dali I knew, others like Eve Tongi and Kay Sage I didn't. Each unknown name made me feel more of an impostor. The fear I felt was no longer mental, but clamped a deep and stinking hold in my bowels. I felt like I needed to pass gas, but I was afraid I might load my pants instead. And that wasn't the worst. Every word I had prepared had gone out of my mind except for the very first line, which was hideously appropriate. "My name is Edgar Freemantle, and I have no idea how I wound up here." It was supposed to elicit a chuckle. It wouldn't, I knew that now. But at least it was true. While Dario droned on, Miro this, Breton surrealist manifesto that, a terrified ex-contractor, stood with his pathetic page of notes clutched in his cold fist. My tongue was a dead slug that might croak, but would speak no coherent word, not to 200 art mavens, many of whom held advanced degrees, some of whom were motherfucking professors.
Worst of all was my brain. It was a dry socket waiting to be filled with pointless, flailing anger. The words might not come, but the rage was always on tap. "Enough!" Dario cried cheerily, striking fresh terror into my pounding heart and sending a cramp rolling through my miserable basement regions. Terror above, barely held in shit below. What a lovely combination. "It has been 15 years since the Scotto added a new artist to its crowded spring calendar, and we have never introduced one in whom there has been greater interest. I think the slides you are about to see and the talk you are about to hear will explain our interest and excitement." He paused dramatically. I felt a poisoned dew of sweat spring out on my brow and wiped it off. The arm that I lifted seemed to weigh 50 pounds. "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Edgar Fremantle, lately of Minneapolis, St. Paul, now of Duma Key." They applauded. It sounded like an artillery barrage going off. I commanded myself to run away. I commanded myself to faint. I did neither. Like a man in a dream, but not a good one, I walked on stage. Everything seemed to be happening slowly. I saw that every seat was taken, but no seat was taken because they were on their feet. They were giving me a standing O. High above me, on the domed ceiling, angels flew in airy disregard of the earthly matters below. And how I wished I was one of them. Dario stood beside the podium, hand outstretched. It was the wrong one. In his own nervousness, he had extended his right, and so my return handshake was awkward and bass-ackwards. My notes were crumpled briefly between our palms, then tore. "Look what you did, you asshole," I thought. And for one terrible moment I was afraid I'd said it aloud for the mic to pick up and broadcast all over the room. I was aware of how bright the spotlight was as Dario left me there on my lonely perch. I was aware of the microphone on its flexible chrome rod and thinking it looked like a cobra rising out of a snake charmer's basket. I was aware of bright points of light shining on that chrome and on the rim of the water glass and on the neck of the Evian bottle next to the water glass. I was aware that the applause was starting to taper off. Some of the people were resuming their seats. Soon an expectant silence would replace the applause. They would wait for me to begin. Only I had nothing to say. Even my opening line had left my head. They would wait and the silence would stretch out. There would be a few nervous coughs and then the murmuring would start. Because they were assholes. Just a bunch of looky-loo assholes with rubber necks. And if I managed anything, it would be an angry torrent of words that would sound like the outburst of a man suffering from Tourette's. I'd just call for the first slide. Maybe I could do that much, and the pictures would carry me. I'd have to hope they would. Only when I looked at my page of notes, I saw that not only was it torn straight down the middle, my sweat had blurred the jotting so badly I could no longer make them out. Either that or the stress had created a short circuit between my eyes and my brain. And what was the first slide anyway? A mailbox painting? Sunset with Sephora? I was almost positive neither of those was right. Now everyone was sitting. The applause was finished. It was time for the American primitive to open his mouth and ululate. 3 rows back, sitting on the aisle, was that Nazi Birch Mary Eyre, with what looked like a port-hand shad open on her lap. I looked for Wireman. He'd gotten me into this, but I bore him no anus. I only wanted to apologize with my eyes for what was coming. "I'll be in the front row," he said. "Dead center." And he was. Jack, my housekeeper Juanita, Jimmy Yoshida, and Alice O'Coin were sitting on Wireman's left. And on his right, on the aisle. The man on the aisle had to be a hallucination. I blinked, but he was still there. A vast face, dark and calm. A figure crammed so tightly into the plush auditorium seat, it seemed it might take a crowbar to get him out again. Xander Kamen, peering up at me through his enormous horn-rimmed glasses and looking more like a minor god than ever. Obesity had canceled his lap, but balanced on the bulge of his belly was a ribbon-garnished gift box about 3 feet long. He saw my surprise, my shock, and made a gesture, not a wave, but an odd, beneficent salute, putting the tips of his fingers first to his massive brow, then to his lips, then holding his hand out to me with the fingers spread. I could see the pallor of his palm. He smiled up at me, as if his presence here in the first row of the Gelbart Auditorium next to my friend Wireman were the most natural thing in the world. His large lips formed four words, one after the other. You can do this. And maybe I could. If I thought away from this moment, if I thought sideways, I thought of Wireman looking west, to be exact, and my opening line came back to me. I nodded to Cayman. Cayman nodded back. Then I looked at the audience and saw they were just people. All the angels were over our heads, and they were now flying in the dark. As for demons, most were probably in my mind. Hello, I began, then recoiled at the way my voice boomed out from the microphone. The audience laughed, but the sound didn't make me angry, as it would have a minute before. It was only laughter, and good-natured. I can do this. Hello, I said, again. My name is Edgar Freemantle, and I'm probably not going to be very good at this. In my other life, I was in the building trade. I knew I was good at that because I landed jobs. In my current life, I paint pictures. But nobody said anything about public speaking. This time the laughter was a little freer and a little more general. I was going to start by saying I have no idea how I wound up here, but actually I do. And that's good, because it's all I have to tell. You see, I don't know anything about art history, art theory, or even art appreciation. Some of you probably know Mary Iyer. This brought a chuckle, as if I'd said, some of you may have heard of Andy Warhol. The lady herself looked around, preening a little, her back ramrod straight. When I first brought some of my paintings into the Scotto Gallery, Miss Iyer saw them and called me an American primitive. I sort of resented that because I change my underwear every morning and brush my teeth every night before I go to bed. Another burst of laughter. My legs were just legs again, not cement. And now that I felt capable of running away, I no longer wanted or needed to. It was possible they'd hate my pictures, but that was all right because I didn't hate them. Let them have their little laugh, their little boo and hiss, their little gasp of distaste, or their little yawn, if that's what they wanted to do. When it was over, I could go back and paint more. And if they loved them, same deal. But if she meant I'm someone who's doing something he doesn't understand, that he can't express in words because no one ever taught him the right terms, then she's right. Cayman was nodding and looking pleased, and so, by God, was Mary Iyer. So all that leaves is the story of how I got here, the bridge I walked over to get from my other life to the one I'm living these days. Cayman was patting his meaty hands together soundlessly. That made me feel good. Having him there made me feel good. I don't know exactly what would have happened if he hadn't have been, but I think it would have been what Wireman calls mucho feo, very ugly. But I have to keep it simple, because my friend Wireman says that when it comes to the past, we all stack the deck, and I believe that's true. Tell too much and you find yourself, I don't know, telling the past you wished for? I looked down and saw Wireman was nodding. Yeah, I think so, the one you wished for. So simply put, what happened is this. I had an accident at a job site. Bad accident. There was this crane, you see. And it crushed the pickup truck I was in, and it crushed me as well. I lost my right arm, and I almost lost my life. I was married, but my marriage broke up. I was at my wit's end. This is a thing I see more clearly now. I only knew then that I felt very, very bad. Another friend, a man named Xander Cayman, asked me one day if anything made me happy. That was something. I paused. Cayman looked up intently from the first row with a long gift box balanced on his non-lap. I remembered him that day at Lake Phelan, the tatty briefcase, the cold autumn sunshine coming and going in diagonal stripes across the living room floor. I remembered thinking about suicide and the myriad roads leading into the dark, turnpikes and secondary highways and shaggy little forgotten lanes. The silence was spinning out, but I no longer dreaded it, and my audience seemed not to mind. It was natural for my mind to wander. I was an artist. The idea of happiness, at least as it applied to me, was something I hadn't thought of in a long time, I said. I thought of supporting my family, and after I started my own company, I thought of not letting down the people who worked for me. I also thought of becoming a success and worked for it, mostly because so many people expected me to fail. Then the accident happened. Everything changed. I discovered I had no... I reached out for the word I wanted, groping with both hands, although they only saw one, and perhaps a twitch of the old stump inside its pinned-up sleeve. I had no resources to fall back on, as far as happiness went. I shrugged. I told my friend Kamen that I used to draw, but I hadn't done it in a long time. He suggested I take it up again. And when I asked why, he said because I needed hedges against the night. I didn't understand what he meant then, because I was lost and confused and in pain. I understand it better now. People say night falls, but down here it rises. It rises out of the gulf after sunset's done. Seeing that happen amazed me. I was also amazed at my own unplanned eloquence. My right arm was quiet throughout. My right arm was just a stump inside a pinned-up sleeve. Could we have the lights all the way down, including mine, please? Alice was running the board herself and wasted no time. The spotlight in which I had been standing dimmed to a whisper. The auditorium was swallowed in gloom. I said, "What I discovered crossing the bridge between my two lives is that sometimes beauty grows in spite of all expectations. But that's not a very original idea, is it? It's really just a platitude, sort of like a Florida sunset. Nevertheless, it happens to be the truth, and the truth deserves to be spoken, if you can say it in a new way." I tried to put it in a picture. "Alice, could we have the first slide, please?" It shone out on the large screen to my right, 9 feet wide and 7 feet high, a trio of gigantic, lush roses growing from a bed of dark pink shells. They were dark because they were below the house, in the shadow of the house. The audience drew in its breath, a sound like a brief but loud gust of wind. I heard that sound and knew it wasn't just wiremen and the folks at the Skoda who understood, who saw. They gasped the way people do when they have been blindsided by something completely unexpected. Then they began to applaud. It went on for almost a full minute. I stood there gripping the left side of the podium, listening, dazed. The rest of the presentation took about 25 minutes, but I remember very little of it. I was like a man conducting a slideshow in a dream. I kept expecting to wake up in my hospital bed, hot and shot through with pain, roaring for morphine. 12. That dreamlike feeling persisted through the post-lecture reception at the Skoda. I had no sooner finished my glass of champagne, bigger than a thimble, but not much, before a second was thrust into my hand. I was toasted by people I didn't know. There were shouts of "hear, hear," and one cry of "maestro." I looked around for my new friends and didn't see them anywhere. Not that there was much time to look. The congratulations seemed endless, both on my talk and on the slides. At least I didn't have to deal with any extended critiques of my technique, because the actual paintings, plus a few sketches in colored pencil for good measure, were squirreled away in two of the large back rooms, safely under lock and key. And the secret of avoiding getting smashed at your reception if you're a one-armed man, I was discovering, was to constantly keep a bacon-wrapped shrimp in your remaining paw. Mary Iyer came by and asked if we were still on for our interview. "Sure," I said. "Although I don't know what else I can tell you. I think I said it all this evening." "Oh, we'll think of a few things," she said, and damned if she didn't tip me a wink from behind her 1950s-style cat's-eye glasses as she handed her champagne flute back to one of the circulating waiters. "Day after tomorrow. A bientôt, monsieur." "You bet," I said, restraining an urge to tell her that if she was going to speak French, she'd have to wait until I was wearing my Manet beret. She wafted off, kissing Dario on one cheek before slipping out into the fragrant March night. Jack came over, snagging a couple of champagne flutes on the way. Juanita, my housekeeper, looking trim and chic in a little pink suit, was with him. She took a skewered shrimp but refused the champagne. He held out the glass to me instead, waiting until I swallowed the last of my hors d'oeuvre and took it. Then he clinked his own against it. "Congrats, boss, you rocked the house." "Thanks, Jack, a critic I can actually understand." I swallowed the champagne, a swallow per flute is all there was, and turned to Juanita. "You look absolutely beautiful."
"Gracias, Mr. Edgar,"
she said and glanced around.
"These pictures are nice, but yours are much better."
"Thank you." Jack handed Juanita another shrimp. "Will you excuse us a couple seconds?"
"Of course."
Jack drew me to the side of a splashy Gerstein sculpture. "Mr. Kamen asked wiremen if they could stay behind a little at the Lib after the joint cleared out."
"He did?"
I felt a tickle of concern.
"Why?"
"Well, he spent most of the day getting down here, and he said that him and airplane heads really don't get along." Jack grinned. "He told Wireman he'd been sitting on something all day and sort of wanted to climb down off it in peace." I burst out laughing. Yet I was also touched. It couldn't be easy for a man of Cayman's size to travel on public transport. And now that I really considered the matter, I guessed it would be impossible for him to sit down in one of those paltry airplane bathrooms at all. To stand up and take a leak? Maybe. Barely. But not sit down. He simply wouldn't fit. "Anyway, Wireman thought Mr. Kamen deserved a T.O. Said you'd understand."
"I do," I said, and beckoned Juanita over.
She looked too lonely standing there by herself in what was probably her best outfit, while the culture vultures ebbed and flowed around her. I gave her a hug, and she smiled up at me. And just as I was finally persuading her to take one of the glasses of champagne, my use of the word pequeño for small made her giggle, so I assumed it wasn't quite right. Wireman and Kamen, the latter still holding the gift box, came in. Kamen lit up at the sight of me, and that did me more good than several rounds of applause, even with a standing O thrown in. I took a champagne flute from a passing tray, cut through the crowd, and handed it to him. Then I slipped my arm around as much of his bulk as I could and gave him a hug. He hugged back hard enough to make my still tender ribs squall.
"Edgar, you look terrific. I'm so glad." "God is good, my friend. God is good."
"So are you," I said.
"How'd you happen to turn up in Sarasota? Was it Wireman?"
I turned to my compadre of the striped umbrella.
"It was, wasn't it?
You called and asked Kamen if he'd be the mystery guest at my lecture."
Wireman shook his head.
"I called Pam. I was in a panic, muchacho, because I could see you were freaking out about the gig. She said that after your accident, you listened to Dr. Kamen when you wouldn't listen to anyone else. So I called him. I never thought he'd come on such short notice, but here he is."
"Not only am I here, I brought you a gift from your daughters," he said, and handed me the box. "Although you'll have to make do with what I had in stock, because I didn't have time to shop. I fear you may be disappointed."
Suddenly I knew what the present was, and my mouth went dry. Nevertheless, I lodged the box under my stump, pulled away the ribbon, and tore off the paper. I was barely aware of Juanita taking it. Inside was a narrow cardboard box that looked to me like a child's coffin.
Of course, what else would it look like?
Stamped on the lid was "Made in the Dominican Republic."
"Classy, Doc," Wireman said.
"I didn't have time to do something nicer, I'm afraid," Kamen replied.
Their voices seemed to come from far away. Juanita removed the box top. I think Jack took that. And then Reba was looking up at me, this time in a red dress instead of a blue one. But the polka dots were the same. So were the shiny black Mary Janes, the lifeless red hair, and the blue eyes that said, "Oh, you nasty man, I've been in here all this time." Still, from a great distance, Kamen was saying,
"Ilsa was the one who called and suggested a doll as a present. This was after she and her sister talked on the phone."
Of course it was Ilsa, I thought. I was aware of the steady murmur of conversation in the gallery, like the sound of the shells on her big pink. My, oh gosh, how nice, smile was still nailed to my face, but if someone had poked me in the back just then, I might have screamed. Ilsa is the one who's been on Duma Key, who's been down the road that leads past El Palacio. As shrewd as he was, I don't think Cayman had any idea that anything was wrong. But of course, he'd been traveling all day and was far from his best. Wireman, however, was looking at me with his head cocked slightly to one side and his brow furrowed. And by then, I think Wireman knew me better than Dr. Cayman ever had.
She knew you already had one, Cayman was saying. She thought a pair would remind you of both daughters, and Melinda agreed, but of course Lucy's are all I have.
Lucy's? Wireman asked, taking the doll. Her pink rag-stuffed legs dangled. Her shallow eyes stared.
They look like Lucille Ball, don't you think? I give them to some of my patients, and of course they give them their own names. What did you name yours, Edgar?
For a moment the old frost descended on my brain, and I thought Rhonda, Robin, Rachel, sit in the buddy, sit in the chum, sit in the fucking char. Then I thought it was Red.
Reba, I said, just like the country singer.
And do you still have her? Cayman asked.
Ilsa said you did.
Oh, yes, I said, and remembered Wireman talking about the Powerball. How you could close your eyes and hear the numbers falling into place, click and click and click. I thought I could hear that now. The night I'd finished Wireman Looks West, I'd had visitors at Big Pink. Little refugees seeking shelter from the storm. Elizabeth's drowned sisters, Tessie and Laura Eastlake. Now I was meant to have twins in Big Pink again. And why? Because something had reached out, that was why. Something had reached out and put the idea in my daughter's head. This was the next click of the wheel, the next ping-pong ball to pop out of the basket.
Edgar? Wireman asked. Are you all right, muchacho?
Yes, I said and smiled. The world came swimming back in all its light and color. I made myself take the doll from Juanita, who was looking at it with puzzlement. It was a hard thing to do, but I managed.
Thank you, Dr. Cayman.
Xander. He shrugged and spread his hands.
Thank your girls, Ilsa in particular.
I will. Who's ready for another glass of champagne?
They all were.
I replaced my new doll in her box, promising myself two things. One was that neither of my daughters would ever know how badly seeing the damn thing had frightened me. The other promise was that I knew two sisters, two living sisters, who were never, ever going to set foot on Duma Key at the same time. Or ever, if I could help it. That was one promise that I kept. Twelve. Another Florida. One.
All right, Edgar, I think we're almost finished.
Maybe she saw something on my face because Mary laughed.
Has it been that awful?
No, I said. And it hadn't been really, although her questions about my technique had made me feel uncomfortable. What it came down to was I looked at things, then slopped on the paint. That was my technique. And influences? What could I say? The light. It always came down to the light, both in the pictures I like to look at and the ones I like to paint. What it did to the surface of things, and what it seemed to suggest about what was inside, hunting a way out. But that didn't sound scholarly. To my ears, it sounded goofy. Okay, she said. Last subject. How many more paintings are there? We were sitting in Mary Iyer's penthouse apartment on Davis Islands, a Tony Tampa enclave, which looked to me like the Art Deco capital of the world. The living room was a vast, nearly empty space with a couch at one end and two slingback chairs at the other. There were no books, but then there was no TV either. On the east wall, where it would catch the early light, was a large David Hockney. Mary and I were at opposite ends of the couch. She had her shorthand pad in her lap. There was an ashtray perched beside her on the arm of the sofa. Between us was a big silver Wallensack tape recorder. It had to be 50 years old, but the reels turned soundlessly. German engineering, baby. Mary wore no makeup, but her lips were coated with clear goo that made them shine. Her hair was tied up in a careless, coming-apart twist that looked simultaneously elegant and slatternly. She smoked English ovals and sipped what looked like straight scotch from a Waterford tumbler. She offered me a drink and seemed disappointed when I opted for bottled water. She wore tailored cotton slacks. Her face looked old, used, and sexy. Its best days might have been around the time Bonnie and Clyde was playing in theaters, but her eyes were still breathtaking, even with lines at the corners, cracks in the eyelids, and no makeup to enhance them. They were Sophia Loren eyes. You showed 22 slides at the Selby. 9 were of pencil sketches, very interesting but small, and 11 paintings, because there were actually 3 slides of Wireman Looks West, 2 close-ups and the wide angle. So how many other paintings are there? How many will you be showing at the Scoto next month? Well, I said, I can't say for sure, because I'm painting all the time, but I think right now there are about 20 more. 20, she said softly and tonelessly. 20 more. Something about the way she was looking at me made me uncomfortable, and I shifted around. The sofa creaked. I think the actual number might be 21. Of course, there were a few pictures I wasn't counting, Friends with Benefits, for instance. The one I sometimes thought of as Candy Brown Loses His Breath, and the Red Robe sketch. So, over 30 in all. I did the addition in my head and shifted around some more. I guess so. And you have no idea how amazing that is. I can see by your face that you don't. She got up, dumped her ashtray in a wastebasket behind the couch, then stood looking at the Hockney with her hands in the pockets of her expensive slacks. The painting showed a cube of a house and a blue swimming pool. Beside the pool was a ripe teenager in a black tank suit. She was all breasts and long tanned legs and dark hair. She wore dark glasses, and a tiny sun blazed in each lens. "Is that an original?" I asked. "Yes, indeed," she said without turning. "The girl in the swimsuit is an original, too. Mary Eyre, circa 1962. Gidget in Tampa." She turned to me, her face fierce. "Turn that tape recorder off. The interview is over." I turned it off. "I want you to listen to me, will you?" "Of course." "There are artists who labor for months over a single painting of half the quality your work shows. Of course, many spend their mornings getting over the excesses of the night before, but you're producing these things like a man working on an assembly line, like a magazine illustrator or a comic book artist." "I grew up believing folks were supposed to work hard at what they do. I think that's all it is. When I had my own company, I worked much longer hours, because the hardest boss a man can ever have is himself." She nodded. "Not true for everyone, but when it is true, it's really true, I know. I just carried that, you know, that ethic over to what I do now. And it's all right. Hell, it's better than all right. I turn on the radio. It's like I go into a daze and I paint." I was blushing. "I'm not trying to set the world's land speed record or anything." "I know that," she said. "Tell me, do you block?" "Block?" I knew what the word meant in a football context. Otherwise, I was drawing a blank. "What's that?" "Never mind. In Wireman Looks West, which is staggering, by the way, that brain. How did you set the features?" "I took some pictures," I said. "I'm sure you did, darling. But when you got ready to paint the portrait, how did you set the features?"
Did you use the third eye rule?" "Third eye rule? I've never heard of any third eye rule." She smiled at me kindly. "In order to get the right spacing between a subject's eyes, painters will often imagine, or even block, a third eye between the two actual ones." "What about the mouth? Did you center it using the ears?"
"No. That is, I didn't know you were supposed to do that." Now it felt as if I were blushing all over my body.
"Relax," she said. "I'm not suggesting y'all start following a bunch of bullshit art school rules after breaking them so spectacularly. It's just..."
She shook her head.
30 paintings since last November? No, it's even less time than that, because you didn't start painting right away."
"Of course not. I had to get some art supplies first. I said, and Mary laughed herself into a coughing fit that she washed away with a sip of scotch. If 30 paintings in 3 months is what almost getting crushed to death does, she said when she could talk again, maybe I ought to find me a crane.
You wouldn't want to, I said, believe me.
I got up, went to the window, and looked down on Adelia Street. This is some place you've got here. She joined me, and we looked out together. The sidewalk cafe directly across and 7 stories below might have been airlifted in from New Orleans or Paris. A woman strolled up the sidewalk eating what looked like a baguette, the hem of her red skirt swirling. Somewhere someone was playing a 12-bar guitar blues, every note ringing clear.
Tell me something, Edgar. When you look out there, does what you see interest you as an artist or as the builder you used to be?
Both, I said. She laughed.
Fair enough. Davis Islands is entirely artificial, the brainchild of a man named Dave Davis. He was Jay Gatsby, Florida style. Have you heard of him?
I shook my head.
That just proves that fame's a fleeting thing. During the Roaring Twenties, Davis was a god down here on the Suncoast.
She waved an arm at the tangled streets below. The bangles on her scrawny wrist jangled. Somewhere not too distant, a church bell marked the hour of 2. He dredged the whole thing from swampland at the mouth of the Hillsborough River, talked the Tampa City fathers into moving both the hospital and the radio station here, back when radio was a bigger deal than healthcare. He built strange and beautiful apartment complexes in a time when the concept of an apartment complex was unknown. He put up hotels and swank nightclubs. He threw the dough around. Married a beauty contest winner, divorced her, married her again. He was worth millions when $1 million was worth what $12 million is today. And one of his best friends lived just down the coast on Duma Key. John Eastlake. Familiar with that name?
Of course. I've met his daughter. My friend Wireman takes care of her.
Mary lit a fresh cigarette. Well, both Dave and John were rich as Croesus. Dave with his land and building speculations, John with his mills. But Davis was a peacock, and Eastlake was more of a plain brown wren. Just as well for him, because you know what happens to peacocks, don't you? They get their tail feathers chopped off. She took a drag on her latest cigarette, then pointed the fingers holding it at me as she jetted smoke from her nostrils.
That would be correct, sir.
In 1925, the Florida land bust hit this state like a brick on a soap bubble. Dave Davis had invested pretty much everything he had in what you see out there. She waved at the zigzaggy streets and pink buildings. In 1926, Davis was owed $4 million on various successful ventures and collected something like $30,000.
It had been a while since I'd ridden on the tiger's neck, which is what my father called overextending your resources, to the point where you had to start juggling your creditors and getting creative with your paperwork. And I'd never ridden that far up, even in the Fremantle Company's early desperate days. I felt for Dave Davis, long dead though he must be.
How much of his own debts could he cover? Any?
He managed at first. Those were boom years in other parts of the country.
You know a lot about this.
Suncoast art is my passion, Edgar. Suncoast history is my hobby.
I see. Davis survived the land bust.
For a short while. I imagine he sold his stocks on the bull market to cover his first round of losses, and friends helped him.
Eastlake?
John Eastlake was a major angel, and that's aside from any of Dave's bootleg hooch he may have stored out on the quay from time to time.
Did he do that? I asked.
Maybe.
That was another time in another Florida. You hear all sorts of colorful Prohibition-era booze-running stories if you live down here a while. Booze or no booze, Davis would have been flat broke by Easter of 26 without John Eastlake. John was no playboy, didn't go nightclubbing and cat-housing like Davis and some of Davis's other friends. But he'd been a widower since 1923, and I'm guessing that old Dave might have helped a pal with a gal from time to time when his pal was feeling lonely. But by the summer of 26, Dave's debts were just too high. Not even his old pals could save him.
So he disappeared one dark night.
He disappeared, but not by the dark of the moon. That was not the Davis style. In October of 1926, less than a month after Hurricane Esther knocked the living hell out of his life's work, he sailed for Europe with a bodyguard and his new gal pal, who happened to be a Mack Sennett bathing beauty. The gal pal and the bodyguard got to Gay Paris, but Dave Davis never did. He disappeared at sea without a trace. This is a true story you're telling me? She raised her right hand in the Boy Scout salute, the image slightly marred by the cigarette smoldering between her first two fingers. True blue. In November of 26, there was a memorial service right over there. She pointed toward where the gulf twinkled between two bright pink Art Deco buildings. At least 400 people attended, many of them, I understand, the sort of women who were partial to ostrich feathers. One of the speakers was John Eastlake. He tossed a wreath of tropical flowers into the water. She sighed, and I caught a waft of her breath. I had no doubt that the lady could hold her liquor. I also had no doubt that she was well on her way to squiffy, if not outright drunk, this afternoon. Eastlake was undoubtedly sad about the passing of his friend, she said. But I bet he was congratulating himself on surviving Esther. I bet they all were. Little did he know he'd be throwing more wreaths into the water less than 6 months later. Not just one daughter gone, but two. Three, I suppose, if you count the eldest. She eloped to Atlanta with a foreman from one of Daddy's mills, if memory serves. Although that's hardly the same as losing two in the Gulf. God, that must have been hard. They are gone, I said, remembering the headline Wireman had quoted. She glanced at me sharply. So you've done some research of your own? Not me, Wireman. He was curious about the woman he was working for. I don't think he knows about the connection to this Dave Davis. She looked thoughtful. I wonder how much Elizabeth herself remembers. These days she doesn't even remember her own name, I said. Mary gave me another look, then turned from the window, got her ashtray, and put out her cigarette. Alzheimer's? I'd heard rumors. Yes. I'm goddamn sorry to hear it. I got the more lurid details of the Dave Davis story from her, you know. In better days. I used to see her all the time on the circuit. And I interviewed most of the artists who stayed at Salmon Point. Only you call it something else, don't you? Big Pink. She smiled. I knew it was something cute. How many artists stayed there? Lots. They came to lecture in Sarasota or Venice and perhaps to paint for a while, although those who stayed at Salmon Point did precious little of that. For most of Elizabeth's guests, their time on Doom McKee amounted to little more than a free vacation. She provided the place gratis? Oh, yes, she said, smiling rather ironically. The Sarasota Arts Council paid the honoraria for their lectures, and Elizabeth usually provided the lodging. Big Pink, nay, Salmon Point. But you didn't get that deal, did you? Perhaps next time, especially since you actually work there. I could name half a dozen artists who stayed in your house and never so much as wet a brush. She marched to the sofa, lifted her glass, and had a sip. No, a swallow. Elizabeth has a dolly sketch that was done at Big Pink, I said. That I saw with my own eyes. Mary's eyes gleamed. Oh, yes, well, Dolly. Dolly loved it there. But not even he stayed long. Although before he left, the son of a bitch goofed me. Do you know what Elizabeth told me after he left? I shook my head. Of course I didn't, but I wanted to hear. He said it was too rich. Does that strike a chord with you, Edgar? I smiled. Why do you suppose Elizabeth turned Big Pink into an artist's retreat? Was she always a patron of the arts? She looked surprised. Your friend didn't tell you? Perhaps he doesn't know. According to local legend, Elizabeth was once an artist of some note herself. What do you mean, according to local legend? There's a story, for all I know it's pure myth, that she was a child prodigy. That she painted beautifully, while very young, and then just stopped. Did you ever ask her? Of course, silly man. Asking people things is what I do. She was swaying a bit on her feet now, the Sophia Loren eyes noticeably bloodshot. What did she say?
That there was nothing to it. She said, those who can do and those who can't support those who can. Like us, Mary.
Sounds good to me, I said.
Yes, it did to me, too, Mary said, taking another sip from her Waterford tumbler. The only problem I had with it is I didn't believe it.
Why not?
I don't know. I just didn't. I had an old friend named Aggie Winterbourne, who used to do the Advice to the Lovelorn column in the Tampa Trib, and I happened to mention the story once to her. This was around the time Dolly was favoring the Suncoast with his presence, maybe 1980. We were in a bar somewhere. In those days, we were always in a bar somewhere. And the conversation had turned to how legends are built. I mentioned the story of how Elizabeth had supposedly been a baby Rembrandt as an example of that. And Aggie, long dead, God rest her, said she didn't think that was a legend. She thought it was the truth, or a version of it. She said she'd seen a newspaper story about it.
Did you ever check? I asked.
Of course I did. I don't write everything I know. She tipped me a wink. But I like to know everything.
What did you find?
Nothing. Not in the Tribune, not in the Sarasota or Venice papers either. So maybe it was just a story. Hell, maybe all that stuff about her father storing Dave Davis's whiskey on Doo McKee was just a story, too, but I'd have bet money on Aggie Winterbourne's memory. And Elizabeth had a look on her face when I asked her about it.
What kind of look?
And I'm not telling you, look. But all that's a long time ago. Much booze under the bridge since, and you can't ask her about it now, can you? Not if she's as bad as you say.
No, but maybe she'll come back. Wireman says she has before.
We'll hope, Mary said. She's a rarity, you know. Florida's full of old people. They don't call it God's waiting room for nothing. But precious few of them grew up here. The Suncoast Elizabeth remembers. Remembered. Really was another Florida. Not the hurry-scurry sprawl we have now, with the domed stadiums and the turnpikes going everywhere. And not the one I grew up in, either. Mine was the John D. McDonald Florida, back when people in Sarasota still knew their neighbors and the Tamiami Trail was a honky-tonk. Back then, people still sometimes came home from church to find alligators in their swimming pools and bobcats rooting in their trash. She was actually very drunk, I realized. But that didn't make her uninteresting. The Florida Elizabeth and her sisters grew up in was the one that existed after the Indians were gone, but before old Mr. White Man had fully consolidated his hold. Your little island would have looked very different to you. I've seen the pictures. It was cabbage palms covered in strangler fig and gumbo limbo and slash pine inland. It was live oak and mangrove, and the few places the ground was wet. There was Cherokee bean and inkberry low on the ground, but none of that jungle shit that's growing out there now. The beaches are the only thing that's the same, and the sea oats, of course, like the hem of a skirt. The drawbridge was there at the north end, but there was just one house.
What caused all that growth? I asked.
Do you have any idea? I mean, 3/4 of the island is buried in it.
She might not have heard.
Just the one house, she repeated, sitting up there on the little rise of ground toward the south end and looking like something you'd see on the Gracious Homes tour in Charleston or Mobile. Pillars and a crushed gravel drive. You had your grand view of the Gulf to the west, your grand view of the Florida coast, looking east. Not that there was much to see, just Venice. Village of Venice, sleepy little village.
She heard how she sounded and pulled herself together. Excuse me, Edgar, please, I don't do this every day. Really, you should take my excitement as a compliment.
I do. 20 years ago, I would have tried to get you into bed instead of drinking myself stupid. Maybe even 10. As it is, I can only hope I haven't scared you away for good.
No such luck.
She laughed, a call both barren and cheery. Then I hope you'll come back soon. I make a mean red gumbo,
But right now?
She put an arm around me and led me to the door. Her body was thin and hot and rock hard beneath her clothes. Her gait was just south of steady. Right now, I think it's time for you to go and for me to take my afternoon siesta. I regret to say I need it. I stepped out into the hall, then turned back. Mary, did you ever hear Elizabeth speak of the deaths of her twin sisters? She would have been 4 or 5, old enough to remember something so traumatic. Never, Mary said. Never once. 2. There were a dozen or so chairs lined up outside the lobby doors, in what was a thin but comfortable band of shade at 2:15 in the afternoon. Half a dozen oldsters were sitting there, watching the traffic on Adelia Street. Jack was also there, but he was neither watching the traffic nor admiring the passing ladies. He was tipped back against the pink stucco and reading Mortuary Science for Dummies. He marked his place and got up as soon as he saw me. Great choice for this state, I said, nodding at the book with the trademark google-eyed nerd on the cover. I've got to pick a career sometime, he said. The way you're moving lately, I don't think this job is going to last much longer. Don't hurry me, I said, feeling in my pocket to make sure I had my little bottle of aspirin. I did. Actually, Jack said, that's just what I'm going to do. Have you got someplace you have to be? I asked, limping down the cement, walking beside him and into the sunshine. It was hot. There's spring on the west coast of Florida, but it only stops for a cup of coffee before heading north to do the heavy work. No, but you've got a 4 o'clock appointment with Dr. Hadlock in Sarasota. I think we can just make it if the traffic's kind. I stopped him with a hand on the shoulder. Elizabeth, doctor? What are you talking about? For a physical. Word on the street is you've been putting it off, boss. Wireman did this, I muttered and ran my hand through my hair. Wireman, the doctor hater. I'll never let him hear the end of it. You're my witness, Jack. I will never. Nope. He said you'd say that, Jack said. He tugged me back into motion. Come on, come on. We'll never beat the rush hour traffic if we don't get rolling. Who? If Wireman didn't make the appointment, then who? Your other friend, the big black dude. Man, I liked him. He was totally chilly. We'd reached the Malibu and Jack opened the passenger door for me. But for a moment I just stood there looking at him, thunderstruck. Cayman? Yep. Him and Dr. Hadlock got talking at your reception after the lecture, and Dr. Cayman just happened to mention that he was concerned because you still hadn't had the checkup you'd been promising to get. Dr. Hadlock volunteered to give you one. Volunteered, I said. Jack nodded, smiling in the bright Florida sunshine. Impossibly young, with a canary-yellow copy of Mortuary Science for Dummies tucked under his arm. Hadlock told Dr. Cayman they couldn't let anything happen to such an important newly discovered talent. And just for the record, I agree. Thanks a pantload, Jack. He laughed. You're a trip, Edgar. May I assume I am also chilly? Yep, you're a bad refrigerator. Get in. Let's get back over the bridge while we still can. 3. As it happened, we got to Dr. Hadlock's Beneva Road office on the dot. Fremantle's theorem of office waiting states that one must add 30 minutes to the time of one's appointment to arrive at the time one is actually seen. But in this case, I was pleasantly surprised. The receptionist called my name at only 10 past the hour and ushered me into a cheerful examination room where a poster to my left depicted a heart drowning in fat, and one to my right showed a lung that looked charbroiled. The eye chart directly ahead was a relief, even though I wasn't much good after the 6th line. A nurse came in, put a thermometer under my tongue, took my pulse, wrapped a blood pressure cuff around my arm, inflated it, studied the readout. When I asked her how I was doing, she smiled noncommittally and said, "You pass." Then she drew blood. After that, I retired to the bathroom with a plastic cup, sending Cayman bitter vibes as I unzipped my fly. A one-armed man can provide a urine sample, but the potential for accidents is greatly magnified. When I returned to the examination room, the nurse was gone. She had left a folder with my name on it. Beside the folder was a red pen. My stump gave a twinge. Without thinking about what I was doing, I took the pen and put it in my pants pocket. There was a blue Bic clipped to my shirt pocket. I took it out and put it where the red pen had been lying. "And what are you going to say when she comes back?" I asked myself. "That the pen fairy came in and decided to make a swap?" Before I could answer that question, or consider why I had stolen the red pen to begin with, Gene Hadlock came in and offered his hand. His left hand, which in my case was the right one. I found I liked him quite a lot better when he was divorced from Principe, the goateed neurologist. He was about 60, a little on the pudgy side, with a white mustache of the toothbrush variety and a pleasant examining table manner. He had me strip down to my shorts and examined my right leg and side at some length. He prodded me in several places, inquiring about the level of pain. He asked me what I was taking for painkillers and seemed surprised when I told him I was getting by on aspirin. "I'm going to examine your stump," he said. "Is that all right?" "Yes, just take it easy." "I'll do my best." I sat with my left hand resting on my bare left thigh, looking at the eye chart as he grasped my shoulder with one hand and cupped my stump in the other. The seventh line on the chart looked like "A God Said." "A God Said what?" I wondered. From somewhere, very distant, I felt faint pressure. "Hurt?" "No." "Okay. No, don't look down. Just keep looking straight ahead. Do you feel my hand?" "Uh-huh. Way off. Pressure." But no twinge. Why would there be? The arm that was no longer there had wanted the pen, and the pen was in my pocket, so now the arm was asleep again. "And how about this, Edgar? May I call you Edgar?" "Anything but late to dinner." The same pressure, faint. "Now you can look." I looked. One hand was still on my shoulder, but the other was at his side, nowhere near the stump. "Oops." "Not at all. Phantom sensations in the stump of a limb are normal. I'm just surprised at the rate of healing and the lack of pain. I squeezed pretty darn hard to begin with. This is all good." He cupped the stump again and pushed upward. "Does that give pain?" "It did. A dull, low sparkle, vaguely hot." "A little," I said. "If it didn't, I'd be worried." He let go. "Look at the eye chart again. All right?" I did as he asked and decided that all-important seventh line was Agoxeo, which made more sense because it made no sense. "How many fingers am I touching you with, Edgar?" "Don't know." It didn't feel like he was touching me at all. "Now?" "Don't know." "And now?" 3. He was almost up to my collarbone, and I had an idea, crazy but very strong, that I would have been able to feel his fingers everywhere on the stump if I'd been in one of my painting frenzies. In fact, I would have been able to feel his fingers in the air below the stump. Then I think he would have been able to feel me, which would no doubt have caused the good doctor to run screaming from the room. He went on, first to my leg, then my head. He listened to my heart, looked into my eyes, and did a bunch of other doctorly things. When he'd exhausted most of the possibilities, he told me to get dressed and meet him at the end of the hall. This turned out to be a pleasantly littered little office. Hadlock sat behind the desk and leaned back in his chair. There were pictures on one wall. Some, I assumed, were of the doctor's family, but there were also shots of him shaking hands with George Bush I and Maury Povich, intellectual equals in my book, and one of him with an amazingly vigorous and pretty Elizabeth Eastlake. They were holding tennis rackets, and I recognized the court. It was the one at El Palacio. "I imagine you'd like to get back to Duma and get off that hip, wouldn't you?" Hadlock asked. "Must hurt by this time of day. And I bet it's all three witches from Macbeth when the weather's damp. If you want a prescription for Percocet or Vicodin." "No, I'm fine with the aspirin," I said. I'd labored to get off the hard stuff, and wasn't going back on it at this point, pain or no pain. "Your recovery is remarkable," Hadlock said. "I don't think you need me to tell you how lucky you are not to be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life, very likely steering yourself around by blowing into a straw." "I'm lucky to be alive at all," I said. "Can I assume you didn't find anything dire?" "Pending blood and urine, I'd say you're good to go." I'm happy to order x-rays on your right side injuries in your head if you've got symptoms that concern you, but I don't. I had symptoms, and they concerned me, but I didn't think x-rays would pinpoint the cause, or causes. He nodded. The reason I went over your stump so carefully was because you don't wear a prosthesis. I thought you might be experiencing tenderness, or there might be signs of infection, but all seems well. I guess I'm just not ready. That's fine. More than fine. Considering the work you're doing, I'd have to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it applies here. Your paintings? Remarkable. I can't wait to see them on display at the Scotto. I'm bringing my wife. She's very excited. That's great, I said. Thank you. This sounded limp, at least to my own ears, but I still hadn't figured out how to respond to such compliments. Having you turn up as an actual paying tenant at Salmon Point is sad and ironic, Hadlock said. For years, you might know this, Elizabeth reserved that house as an artist's retreat. Then she became ill and allowed it to be listed as just another rental property, although she did insist that whoever took it would have to lease it for 3 months or longer. She didn't want any spring breakers partying in there. Not where Salvador Dali and James Bama once laid down their storied heads. I can't say that I blame her. It's a special place. Yes, but few of the famous artists who stayed there did anything special. Then the second regular tenant comes along, a building contractor from Minneapolis, recovering from an accident, and, well, Elizabeth must be very gratified. In the building biz, we called that laying it on with a trowel, Dr. Hadlock. Jean, he said, and the people who were at your lecture didn't think so. You were marvelous. I only wish Elizabeth could have been there. How she would have preened. Maybe she'll make the opening. Very slowly, Jean Hadlock shook his head. I doubt that. She's fought the Alzheimer's tooth and nail, but there comes a time when the disease simply wins. Not because the patient is weak, but because it's a physical condition like MS or cancer. Once the symptoms begin to manifest, usually as a loss of short-term memory, a clock begins to run. I think Elizabeth's time may be up, and I'm very sorry. It's clear to me. I think it was clear to everyone at the lecture that all this fuss makes you uncomfortable. You can say that again. But if she had been there, she would have enjoyed it for you. I've known her most of my life, and I can tell you she would have supervised everything, including the hanging of each and every picture in the gallery. I wish I'd known her then, I said. She was amazing. When she was 45 and I was 20, we won the mixed doubles amateur tennis tournament at the Colony on Longboat Key. I was home from college on semester break. I've still got the cup. I imagine she still got hers somewhere. That made me think of something. You'll find it, I'm sure. But before I could chase the memory to its source, something else occurred to me, something much more recent. Dr. Hadlock, Jean, did Elizabeth herself ever paint or draw? Elizabeth? Never. And he smiled. You're sure of that? You bet. I asked her once, and I remember the occasion very well. It was when Norman Rockwell was in town to lecture. He didn't stay at your place either. He stayed at the Ritz. Norman Rockwell, pipe and all. Jean Hadlock shook his head, smiling more widely now. Ye gods, what a controversy that was. The howling when the Arts Council announced Mr. Saturday Evening Post was coming. It was Elizabeth's idea, and she loved the hubbub it caused. Said they could have filled Ben Hill Griffin Stadium. He saw my blank look. The University of Florida. The swamp where only the Gators come out alive. If you're talking football, my interest begins with the Vikings and ends with the Packers. The point is, I asked her about her own artistic abilities during the Rockwell uproar, and he did indeed sell out. Not the Geldbart either, but City Center. Elizabeth laughed and said she could hardly draw stick figures. In fact, she used a sports metaphor, which is probably why I thought of the Gators. She said she was like one of those wealthy college alumni, except she was interested in art instead of football. She said, if you can't be an athlete, hun, be an athletic supporter. And if you can't be an artist, feed them, care for them, and make sure they have a place to come in out of the rain. But artistic talent herself, absolutely none.
I thought of telling him about Mary Iyer's friend Aggie Winterbourne. Then I touched the red pen in my pocket and decided not to. I decided what I wanted to do was get back to Duma Key and paint. Girl in Ship Number 8 was the most ambitious of the series, also the largest and the most complex, and it was almost done. I stood up and offered my hand. Thank you for everything. Not at all, and if you change your mind and want something a little stronger for the pain. 4. The drawbridge to the quay was up to allow some rich guy's toy to wallow through the pass to the gulf side. Jack sat behind the wheel of the Malibu, admiring the girl in the green bikini who was sunning on the foredeck. The Bone was on the radio. An ad for some motorcycle dealership ended. The Bone was big on motorcycle sales and various mortgage services. And the Who came on, Magic Bus. My stump began to tingle, then to itch. And that itch spread slowly downward, sleepy, but deep, very deep. I inched the volume up a tick, then reached into my pocket and pulled out the stolen pen. Not blue, not black. It was red. I admired it for a moment in the late sun. Then I thumbed open the glove compartment and pawed around. Help you find something, boss? Nope. Keep your eye on yonder, honey. I'm doing fine. I pulled out a coupon for a free Checkers NASCAR burger. You gotta eat, the coupon proclaimed. I turned it over. The flip side was blank. I drew quickly and without thinking. It was done before the song was. Underneath my small picture, I printed 5 letters. The picture was similar to the doodles I'd done in my other life while dickering, usually with some dickhead on the phone. The letters spelled Purse, the name of my mystery ship. Only I didn't think that was how you said it. I could have added an accent over the E, but that would turn it into something that sounded like per se, and I didn't think that was right either. What's that? Jack asked, looking over. Then answered his own question. Little red picnic basket, cute. But what's a purse? You say it Percy. I'll take your word for it. The barrier at our end of the drawbridge went up, and Jack rolled across onto Duma Key. I looked at the little red picnic basket I'd drawn, only I thought you called this kind, the kind with wicker sides, a hamper, and wondered why it looked so familiar. Then I realized it didn't, not exactly. It was the phrase that was familiar. Look for Nan somebody's picnic basket, Elizabeth had said on the night I brought Wireman back from Sarasota Memorial. The last night I had seen her compos mentis, I realized now. It's in the attic. It's red. And you'll find it, I'm sure. And there inside. Only when I had asked her what she was talking about, she hadn't been able to tell me. She had slipped away. It's in the attic. It's red. Of course it is, I said. Everything is. What, Edgar? Nothing, I said, looking at the stolen pen, just thinking out loud. 5. Girl in Ship Number 8, the last in the series. I felt almost sure really was done. But I stood considering it in the lengthening light with my shirt off and the Bone blasting Copperhead Road. I had worked on it longer than any of the others, had come to realize that in many ways it summed up the others, and it was disturbing. That was why I covered it with a piece of sheet at the end of my sessions. Now, looking at it with what I hoped was a dispassionate eye, I realized disturbing was probably the wrong word. That baby was fucking terrifying. Looking at it was like looking at a mind turned sideways. And maybe it would never be completely done. Certainly there was still room for a red picnic basket. I could hang it over the Percy's bowsprit. What the hell, why not? The damn thing was crammed with figures and details as it was. Always room for one more. I was reaching out a brush loaded with what could have been blood to do just that when the phone rang. I almost let it go. Surely would have done. If I'd been in one of my painting trances, but I wasn't. The picnic basket was only meant to be a grace note, and I had already added others.
I put the brush back and picked up the phone. It was Wireman, and he sounded excited.
She had a clear patch this afternoon, Edgar. It might not mean anything. I'm trying to keep my hopes low, but I've seen this before. First one clear interval, then another, then another. Then they start to merge together and she's herself again, at least for a while.
She know who she is, where she is?
Not now, but for half an hour or so, starting around 5:30. She knew that stuff and who I was, too. Listen, muchacho, she lit her own damn cigarette.
I'll be sure to tell the Surgeon General, I said. But I was thinking, 5:30, right around the time Jack and I had been waiting for the drawbridge. Around the time I'd felt that urge to draw. Did she want anything besides a cigarette?
She asked for food, but before that, she asked to go to the China village. She wanted her chinas, Edgar. Do you know how long it's been?
I did, actually, and it was good to hear him excited on her behalf. She started to fade after I got her there, though. She looked around and asked me where Percy was. She said she wanted Percy, that Percy needed to go in the cookie tin. I looked at my painting, at my ship. It was mine now, all right. My Percy. I licked my lips, which suddenly felt leathery, the way they always had when I first woke up after the accident, when some of the time I couldn't remember who I was. Do you know what's queer? Remembering forgetting. It's like looking into a hall of mirrors.
Which one is Percy?
Damned if I know. When she wants me to throw the cookie tin in the goldfish pond, she always insists on putting a girl china in it. Usually the shepherdess, with her face chipped off.
Did she say anything else?
She wanted food, I told you. Tomato soup. And peaches. By then she'd stopped looking at the chinas, and she was getting confused again.
Had she gotten confused because Percy wasn't there? Or the Percy?
Maybe. But if she'd ever had a china boat, I'd never seen it. I thought, not for the first time, that Percy was a funny word. You couldn't trust it. It kept changing.
Wireman said, at one point she told me the table was leaking.
And was it?
There was a brief pause, then he said, not very humorously, are we having a little joke at Wireman's expense, mi amigo?
No, I'm curious. What did she say, exactly?
Just that, the table is leaking. But her chinas are on a table, as you well know, not a water table.
Calm down, don't lose your good thoughts.
I'm trying not to, but I have to say you seem a little off your conversational game, Edster.
Don't call me Edster, it sounds like a vintage Ford.
You brought her soup, and she was, what, gone again?
Pretty much, yeah. She'd broken a couple of her china figures on the floor, a horse and a rodeo girl.
He sighed.
Did she say it's leaking before or after you brought her the food?
After, before, what does it matter?
I don't know, I said. Which was it?
Before, I think. Yes, before. Afterwards, she'd pretty much lost interest in everything, including chucking the sweet Owen tin into the pond for the umpteenth time. I brought the soup in her favorite mug, but she pushed it away so hard she slopped some on her poor old arm. She didn't even seem to feel it.
Edgar, why are you asking these questions? What do you know?
He was pacing around with the cell phone to his ear. I could see him doing it.
Nothing. I'm feeling around in the dark, for Christ's sake.
Yeah? Which arm are you doing it with?
That stopped me for a moment. But we had come too far and shared too much for lies, even when the truth was nuts.
My right one.
All right, he said. All right, Edgar. I wish I knew what was going on, that's all, because something is.
Maybe something is.
How is she now?
Sleeping.
And I'm interrupting you. You're working.
No, I said, and tossed the brush aside. I think this is done. And I think I'm also done for a while. Just walking and shelling for me between now and the show.
Noble aspirations, but I don't think you can do it. Not a workaholic like you.
I think you're wrong.
Okay, I'm wrong. Won't be the first time.
Are you going to come down and visit with us tomorrow?
I want you to see it if she lights up again.
Count on it. And maybe we could hit a few tennis balls.
Fine by me.
Wireman, there's one other thing.
Did Elizabeth ever paint?
He laughed.
Who knows? I asked her once, and she said she could hardly draw stick figures. She said her interest in the arts wasn't much different from the interest some wealthy alumni have in football and basketball. She joked about it, said, "If you can't be an athlete, be an athletic supporter." "Exactly. How'd you know?" "It's an old one," I said. "See you tomorrow." I hung up and stood where I was, watching the long light of evening fire up a Gulf sunset I had no urge to paint. They were the same words she'd used with Jean Hadlock, and I had no doubt that if I asked others, I'd hear the same anecdote once or twice or a dozen times. She said, "I can't even draw stick figures." She said, "If you can't be an athlete, be an athletic supporter." And why? Because an honest woman may occasionally goof the truth, but a good liar never varies her story. I hadn't asked him about the red picnic basket, but I told myself that was all right. If it was in the attic of El Palacio, it would still be there the next day, and the day after that. I told myself there was time. Of course, that's what we always tell ourselves, isn't it? We can't imagine time running out, and God punishes us for what we can't imagine. I looked at girl in ship number 8 with something approaching distaste and threw the cover sheet over it. I never added the red picnic hamper to the bowsprit. I never put a brush to that particular painting again, the final mad descendant of my first sketch in big pink, the one I'd named Hello. Number 8 may have been the best thing I ever did, but in a strange way, I almost forgot it. Until the show, that was. After that, I could never forget it. 6. The picnic basket. That damned red picnic basket full of her drawings. How that haunts me. Even now, 4 years later, I find myself playing the what-if game, wondering how much would have changed if I'd pushed everything else aside and gone hunting for it. It was found by Jack Cantori, but by then it was too late. And maybe, I can't say for sure, it wouldn't have changed anything, because some force was at work, both on Duma Key and inside Edgar Fremantle. Can I say that force brought me there? No. Can I say it didn't? No, I can't say that either. But by the time March became April, it had begun to gain strength and ever so stealthily extend its reach. That basket. Elizabeth's damned picnic basket. It was red. 7. Wireman's hope that Elizabeth was coming around began to seem unjustified. She remained a muttering lump in her wheelchair, every now and then stirring enough to cry out for a cigarette in the cracked voice of an aging parrot. He hired Anne-Marie Whistler away from Bay Area private nursing to come in and help him 4 days a week. The extra help might have eased Wireman's workload, but it did little to comfort him. He was heartsore. But that was something I only glimpsed from the corner of my eye as April rolled in, sunny and hot, because, speaking of hot, there I was. Once Mary Iyer's interview was published, I became a local celebrity. Why not? Artist was good, especially in the Sarasota area. Artist who used to build banks and then turned his back on mammon was better. One-armed artist of blazing talent was the absolute golden motherfucker. Dario and Jimmy scheduled a number of follow-up interviews, including one with Channel 6. I emerged from their Sarasota studio with a blinding headache and a complimentary Channel 6 Suncoast Weather Watcher bumper sticker, which I ended up plastering on one of the Mean Dog's sawhorses. Don't ask me why. I also took over the Florida end of the travel and hospitality arrangements. Wireman was by then too busy trying to get Elizabeth to ingest anything but cigarette smoke. I found myself consulting with Pam every 2 or 3 days about the guest list from Minnesota and travel arrangements from other parts of the country. Ilsa called twice. I thought she was making an effort to sound cheerful, but I could have been wrong. My attempts to find out how her love life was progressing were kindly but firmly blocked. Melinda called, to ask for my hat size, of all things. When I asked why, she wouldn't tell. 15 minutes after she hung up, I realized she and her French ami were really buying me a fucking beret. I burst out laughing.
An AP reporter from Tampa came to Sarasota. He wanted to come to Duma, but I didn't like the idea of a reporter tramping around in big pink, listening to what I now thought of as my shells. He interviewed me at Skoto instead, while a photographer took pictures of three carefully selected paintings, Roses Grow from Shells, Sunset with Sephora, and Duma Road. I was wearing a Casey Key Fish House t-shirt, and a photo of me, baseball cap on backwards and one short sleeve empty, except for a nub of stump, ran nationwide. After that, my telephone rang off the hook. Angel Slobotnik called and talked for 20 minutes. At one point, he said he always knew I had it in me. "What?" I asked. His reply was, "Bullshit, boss!" And we laughed like maniacs. Kathy Green called. I heard all about her new boyfriend, not so good, and her new self-help program, wonderful. I told her about how Kamen had showed up at the lecture and saved my ass. By the end of the call, she was crying and saying she'd never had such a gutty, come-from-behind patient. Then she said when she saw me, she was going to tell me to drop and give her 50 sit-ups. That sounded like the old Kathy. To top it all off, Todd Jameson, the doctor who had probably saved me from a decade or two as a human rutabaga, sent me a bottle of champagne with a card reading, "Cannot wait to see your work." If Wireman had bet me on whether or not I'd get bored and pick up a brush again before the show, he would have lost. When I wasn't getting ready for my big moment, I was walking, reading, or sleeping. I mentioned this to him on one of the rare afternoons when we were together at the end of El Palacio's boardwalk, drinking green tea under the striped umbrella. This was less than a week before the show. "I'm glad," he said simply. "You needed to rest." "What about you, Wireman? How are you doing?"
"Not great, but I will survive. Gloria Gaynor, 1978. It's sadness, mostly." He sighed. "I'm going to lose her. I kidded myself that maybe she was coming back, but I'm going to lose her. It's not like Julia and Esmeralda, thank God, but it still weighs on me.
I'm sorry." I laid my hand over his. "For her and for you."
"Thanks."
He looked out at the waves.
"Sometimes I think she won't die at all."
"No?"
"No, I think the walrus and the carpenter will come for her instead. That they'll just lead her away like they did those trusting oysters. Lead her away down the beach. Do you remember what the walrus says?"
I shook my head.
"It seems a shame to play them such a trick, after we've brought them out so far, and made them trot so quick."
He swiped an arm across his face.
"Look at me, muchacho. Crying just like the walrus. Ain't I stupid?"
"No," I said.
"I hate to face the idea that this time she's gone for good. That the best part of her went off down the beach with a walrus and a carpenter, and there's nothing left but a fat old piece of suet that hasn't quite forgotten how to breathe yet."
I said nothing. He wiped his eyes again with his forearm and drew in a long, watery breath. Then he said,
"I looked into the story of John Eastlake and how his daughters were drowned and what happened after. Do you remember asking me to do that?"
I did, but it seemed long ago and unimportant. What I think now is that something wanted it to seem that way to me.
I went surfing around on the internet and came up with a good deal from the local newspapers and a couple of memoirs that are available for download. One of them, I shit you not, muchacho, is called Boat Trips and Beeswax, A Girlhood in Nokomis by Stephanie Wider Gravel Miller.
Sounds like quite a trip down memory lane.
It was. She talks about the happy darkies picking oranges and singing simple songs of praise in their mellifluous voices.
I guess that was before Jay-Z.
Got that right. Even better, I talked to Chris Shannington over on Casey Key. You've almost certainly seen him. Colorful old geezer who walks every place with his gnarled briarwood cane, almost as tall as he is, and a big straw hat on his head. His father, Ellis Shannington, was John Eastlake's gardener. According to Chris, it was Ellis who took Maria and Hannah, Elizabeth's two older sisters, back to the Braden School 10 days or so after the drowning. He said, "Those children were heartbroken for the Babians."
Wireman's imitation of the old man's southern accent was eerily good.
and I found myself for some reason thinking of the walrus and the carpenter again, walking up the beach with the little oysters. The only part of the poem I could remember clearly was the carpenter telling them they'd had a pleasant run, but of course the oysters couldn't answer, for they'd been eaten, every one. "Do you want to hear this now?" Wireman asked. "Have you got time to tell me now?" "Sure. Anne-Marie's got the duty until 7, although as a matter of practical fact, we share it most days. Why don't we walk up to the house? I've got a file. There isn't much in it, but there's at least one picture that's worth looking at. Chris Shannington had it in a box of his father's things. I walked up to the Casey Key Public Library with him and copied it." He paused. "It's a picture of Heron's Roost."
"As it was back then, you mean?"
We'd started to stroll back up the boardwalk, but Wireman stopped.
"No, amigo, you misunderstand. I'm talking about the original Heron's Roost. El Palacio is the second roost, built almost 25 years after the little girls drowned. By then, John Eastlake's 10 or 20 million had grown to 150 million or so. War is good business. Invest your son."
"Vietnam protest movement, 1969, I said. "Often seen in tandem with a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle."
"Good, amigo," Wireman said.
He waved a hand toward the riotous greenery that began just south of us. "The first Heron's Roost was out there, back when the world was young and flappers said poop-oopy-doop." I thought of Mary Iyer, not just tiddly or squiffy, but downright drunk, saying, "Just the one house, sitting up there and looking like something you'd see on the Gracious Homes tour in Charleston or Mobile." "What happened to it?" I asked.
"So far as I know, nothing but time and decay," he said.
"When John Eastlake gave up on recovering the bodies of his twins, he gave up on Duma Key, too. He paid off most of the help, packed his traps, took the 3 daughters who remained to him, got in his Rolls Royce, he really had one, and drove away. A novel F. Scott Fitzgerald never wrote. That's what Chris Shannington said. Told me Eastlake was never at peace until Elizabeth brought him back here."
"Do you think that's something Shannington actually knows, or just a story he's gotten used to hearing himself tell?"
"Quién sabe," Wireman said. He stopped again and waved toward the southern end of Duma Key. "No overgrowth back then. You could see the original house from the mainland, and vice versa. And so far as I know, amigo, the house is still there. Whatever's left of it, sitting and rotting." He reached the kitchen door and looked at me, unsmiling.
"That would be something to paint, wouldn't it? A ghost ship on dry land."
"Maybe," I said. "Maybe it would." 8. He took me into the library with the suit of armor in the corner and the museum-quality weapons on the wall. There on the table next to the telephone was a folder marked John Eastlake, Heron's Roost 1. He opened it and removed a photograph showing a house that bore an unmistakable similarity to the one we were in. The similarity, say, of first cousins. Yet there was one basic difference between the two. And the similarities, the same basic footprint for both houses, I thought, and the same roof of bright orange Spanish tile, only underlined it. The current Palacio hid from the world behind a high wall broken by only a single gate. There wasn't even a tradesman's entrance. It had a beautiful interior courtyard which few people other than Wireman, Anne-Marie, and the twice-weekly gardener ever saw. It was like the body of a beautiful woman hidden under a shapeless piece of clothing. The first Heron's Roost was very different. Like Elizabeth's mansion in Chinatown, it featured half a dozen pillars and a broad, welcoming veranda. It had a wide drive sweeping boldly up to it, splitting what looked like 2 acres of lawn. Not a gravel drive, either, as Mary Iyer had told me, but rosy, crushed shells. The original had invited the world in. Its successor, El Palacio, told the world to stay the hell out. Ilse had seen that at once, and so had I. But that day we had been looking from the road. Since then my view had changed, and with good reason. I had gotten used to seeing it from the beach, to coming upon it from its unarmored side. The first Heron's Roost had also been higher, 3 stories in front and 4 in back, so, if it really did stand on a rise, as Mary had said, people on the top floor would have had a breathtaking, 360-degree view of the Gulf, the mainland, Casey Key, and Don Pedro Island. Not bad. But the lawn looked strangely ragged, unkempt. And there were holes in the line of ornamental palms dancing like hula girls on either side of the house. I looked closer and saw that some of the upper windows had been boarded up. The roof line had a strangely unbalanced look, too. It took a second to realize why. There was a chimney at the east end. There should have been another at the west end, but there wasn't. "Was this taken after they left?" I asked. He shook his head. According to Shannington, it was snapped in March of 1927, before the little girls drowned, when everyone was still happy and well. That isn't dilapidation, you see, it's storm damage from an Alice. Which is what? Hurricane season officially starts June 15th down here and lasts about 5 months. Out-of-season storms, with torrential rains and high winds. As far as the old-timers are concerned, they're all Alice. As in Hurricane Alice. It's kind of a joke. You're making that up. Nope. Esther, the big one in 26, missed Duma completely. But the Alice in March of 27 hit it pretty much dead on. Then it blew inland and drowned in the Glades. It did the damage you see in this picture. Not much, really. Blew down some palms, knocked out some glass, tore up the lawn. But in another way, its effects are still being felt, because it seems pretty certain that it was that Alice that led to the drowning deaths of Tessie and Laura. And that led to everything else, including you and me standing here now. Explain. Remember this? He took another photo from his folder, and I certainly did remember it. The big one was on the second floor landing of the main staircase. This was a smaller, sharper copy. It was the Eastlake family, with John Eastlake wearing a black bathing singlet and looking like a Hollywood B-list actor who might have specialized in detective movies and jungle epics. He was holding Elizabeth. One hand cupped her plump little bottom. The other held that harpoon pistol and a face mask with an attached snorkel. Judging just by Elizabeth, I'm going to guess that this might have been taken around 1925, Wireman said. She looks 2 going on 3, and Adriana, he tapped the eldest, looks like she might be 17 going on 34, wouldn't you say? Indeed, 17 and ripe. Even in her, it covers damn near everything bathing suit. She's already got that sulky, pouty, I-want-to-be-somewhere-else look, too, Wireman said. I wonder just how surprised her father was when she up and eloped with one of his plant managers. And I wonder if he wasn't, in his heart of hearts, glad to see her go. He put on his Chris Shannington drawl. Run off to Atlanta with a boy and a tie and an eye shade. Then he quit it. I guess the subject of little dead girls, even ones lost 80 years ago, was still a tender one with him. She and her new hubby came back, but by then it was just a hunt for the bodies. I tapped the grim-faced black nanny. Who was this? Melda or Tilda or maybe even, God save us, Hecuba, according to Chris Shannington. His father knew, but Chris no longer remembers. Nice bracelets. He glanced at them without much interest. If you say so. Maybe John Eastlake was sleeping with her, I said. Maybe the bracelets were a little present. Quien sabe? Rich widower? Young woman? Been known to happen. I tapped the picnic basket, which the young black woman was holding with both hands, her arms bunched as though it was heavy. Heavier than just a few sandwiches could account for, you'd think. But maybe there was a whole chicken in there, and maybe a few bottles of beer for old Massa as well, a little reward after he'd finished his day's dives. What color would you say that hamper is? Dark brown? Or is it red? Wireman gave me a strange look. In a black and white photograph, it's hard to tell. Tell me how the storm led to the deaths of the little girls. He opened the folder again and handed me an old news story with an accompanying photograph. This is from the Venice Gondolier, March 28, 1927. I got the original info on the net. Jack Cantori called the paper, got someone to make a copy and shoot me a fax. Jack's terrific, by the way. No argument there, I said.
I studied the photo. Who are these girls? No, don't tell me. The one on the left's Maria. Hannah's on his right. A plus. Hannah's the one with breasts. She was 14 in 27. We studied the fact sheet in silence for a few moments. Email would have been better. The facts had annoying dark vertical lines running through it, blurring some of the print. But the headline was clear enough. Storm proves treasure-hunting boon to amateur diver. And the picture was clear enough, too. Eastlake's hairline had receded a little. As if to compensate, his narrow bandleader's mustache was now closer to a walrus. And although he was still wearing the same black bathing singlet, it was now under severe stress and actually popped under one arm, I thought, although the picture's resolution wasn't quite good enough to be certain. It appeared Dad Eastlake had packed on some pork between 1925 and 1927. The B-movie actor would have trouble getting roles if he didn't start skipping desserts and doing more work in the gym. The girls flanking him weren't as slow-eyed sexy as their big sister. You looked at Adriana and thought about hot afternoons in a haymow. You looked at these two and wondered if they were getting their schoolwork done. But they were pretty in a not-quite-there-yet way, and their excitement shone out in the picture. Sure it did, because spread before them on the sand was treasure. I can't make it all out, and the damn caption's blurry, I complained. There's a magnifying glass in the desk, but let me save you a headache. Wireman picked up a pen and pointed with the tip. That's a medicine bottle, and that there is a musket ball, or so Eastlake claims in the story. Maria's got her hand on what appears to be a boot, or the remains of one. Next to the boot, a pair of spectacles, I said, and a necklace chain? The story claims it's a bracelet, I don't know. All I could swear to is a metal loop of some kind, overgrown with crud. But the older girl's definitely holding out an earring. I scanned the story. In addition to the stuff on view, Eastlake had found various eating utensils. Four cups, he claimed, were Italianate, a trivet, a box of gears, whatever that might mean, and nails without number. He'd also found half a China man. Not a Chinaman, a China man. It wasn't pictured, at least not that I could see. The story said Eastlake had been diving on the eroded reefs west of Duma Key for 15 years, sometimes to fish, often just to relax. He said he had found all sorts of litter, but nothing of interest. He said that the Alice, he called it that, had generated some remarkably big waves, and they must have shifted the sand inside the reef just enough to reveal what he called a dumping field. He doesn't call it a wreck, I said. It wasn't, Wireman said. There was no boat. He didn't find one, and neither did the dozens of people who helped him try to recover the bodies of his little girls. Only detritus. They would have found a wreck if there was a wreck to find. The water on the southwest end of the key is no more than 25 feet deep, all the way out to what remains of Kitt Reef, and it's pretty clear now. Back then it was like turquoise glass. Any theories about how it came to be there? Sure. The best is that some boat close to foundering came blowing in 100, 200, 300 years before, shedding shit as it came. Or maybe the crew was tossing stuff overboard to stay afloat. They made repairs after the storm was over and went on their way. It would explain why there was a swath of detritus for Eastlake to find, and also why none of it was particularly valuable. Treasure would have stayed with the ship. And the reef wouldn't have ripped the keel out of a boat that got blown in here back in the 1700s or the 1600s? Wireman shrugged. Chris Shannington says no one knows what the geography of Kitt Reef might have been 150 years ago. I looked at the spread-out loot, the smiling middle daughters, the smiling daddy, who was soon going to have to buy himself a new bathing costume. And I suddenly decided he hadn't been sleeping with the nanny, no. Even a mistress would have told him he couldn't have a newspaper photo of himself taken in that old thing. She would have found a tactful reason. But the real one was right in front of me. After all these years, even with less than perfect vision in my right eye, I could see it. He was too fat. Only he didn't see it. And his daughters didn't see it either.
loving eyes did not see. Too fat. Something there, wasn't there? Some A that practically demanded a B. I'm surprised he talked about what he found at all, I said. If you happened on stuff like this today and then blabbed to Channel 6, half of Florida would show up in their little putt-putts hunting for doubloons and pieces of eight with metal detectors.
Ah, but this was another Florida, Wireman said, and I remembered Mary Iyer using the same phrase. John Eastlake was a rich man, and Dew McKee was his private preserve. Besides, there were no doubloons, no pieces of eight. Just moderately interesting junk, uncovered by a freak storm. For weeks he went down and dived where that debris was scattered on the floor of the Gulf. And it was close in. According to Shannington, at low tide you could practically wade to it. And sure, he was probably keeping an eye out for valuables. He was a rich man, but I don't think that vaccinates a man against the treasure bug.
No, I said. I'm sure it doesn't. The nanny would have gone with him on his treasure-hunting expeditions. The three still-at-home girls, too. The twins and Elizabeth. Maria and Hannah were back at their boarding school in Bradenton, and Big Sis had run off to Atlanta. Eastlake and his little ones probably had picnics down there. How often? I began to see where this was going. Often. Maybe every day while the debris field was at its richest. They wore a path from the house to what was called Shade Beach. It was half a mile, if that. A path two adventurous little girls could follow on their own. And one day did, to everyone's sorrow. He swept the pictures back into the folder. There's a story here, muchacho, and I suppose it's marginally more interesting than a little girl swallowing a marble, but a tragedy is a tragedy. And at the bottom, all tragedies are stupid. Give me a choice and I'll take A Midsummer Night's Dream over Hamlet anytime. Any fool with steady hands and a working set of lungs can build up a house of cards and then blow it down, but it takes a genius to make people laugh. He brooded a moment. What probably happened is that one day in April of 1927, when Tessie and Laura were supposed to be napping, they decided to get up, sneak down the path, and go hunting for treasure at Shade Beach. Probably they meant to do no more than wade in as far as their knees, which is all they were permitted to do. One of the stories quotes John Eastlake as saying that, and Adriana backed him up. The married daughter who came back. Right. She and her new husband returned a day or two before the search for the bodies was officially called off. That's according to Shannington. Anyway, one of the little girls maybe saw something gleaming a little farther out, started to flounder, then... Then her sister tried to save her. Yes, I could see it. Only I saw Lynn and Ilsa, as they had been when they were small. Not twins, but for 3 or 4 golden years, nearly inseparable. Wireman nodded. And then the rip took them both. Had to have been that way, amigo. That's why the bodies weren't found. Off they went, hi-ho, for the Caldo Largo. I opened my mouth to ask him what he meant by the rip, and then remembered a painting by Winslow Homer, romantic but of undeniable power, Undertow. The intercom on the wall beeped, startling us both. Wireman struck the folder with his arm as he turned around, knocking photocopies and faxes everywhere. "Mr. Wireman!" It was Anne Marie Whistler. "Mr. Wireman, are you there?"
"I'm here," Wireman said.
"Mr. Wireman!"
She sounded agitated. Then, as if to herself, "Jesus, where are you?"
"The fucking button,"
he muttered, and went to the wall unit, not quite running. He pushed the button.
"I'm here. What's wrong? What's happened? Did she fall?"
"No," Anne-Marie cried. "She's awake. Awake and aware. She's asking for you. Can you come?"
"Right away," he said, and turned to me, grinning. "You hear that, Edgar? Come on."
He paused.
"What are you looking at?"
"These," I said, and held out the two pictures of Eastlake in his bathing dress. The one where he was surrounded by all his daughters, and the one taken 2 years later where he was flanked by just Maria and Hannah.
"Never mind them now, didn't you hear? Miss Eastlake is back."
He booked for the door. I dropped his folder on the library table and followed him. I had made the connection, but only because I'd spent the last few months cultivating the art of seeing, cultivating it strenuously. "Wireman," I called. He'd gone the length of the dog trot,
and was halfway up the staircase. I was limping as fast as I could, and he was still pulling away. He waited for me, not very patiently. Who told him the debris field was there?
Eastlake? I assume he stumbled on it while pursuing his diving hobby.
I don't think so. He hadn't been in that bathing suit for a long time. Diving and snorkeling may have been his hobby in the early 20s, but I think that around 1925, eating dinner became his chief diversion. So who told him?
Anne-Marie came out of a door near the end of the hall. There was a goofy, unbelieving grin on her face that made her look half her 40 years.
"Come on," she said. "This is wonderful."
"Is she?"
"She is," came Elizabeth's cracked but unmistakable voice.
"Come in here, Wireman, and let me see your face while I still know it."
9. I lingered in the hall with Anne-Marie, not sure what to do, looking at the knick-knacks and the big old Frederick Remington at the far end, Indians on ponies. Then Wireman called for me. His voice was impatient and rough with tears. The room was dim. The shades had all been drawn. Air conditioning whispered through a vent somewhere above us. There was a table next to her bed with a lamp on it. The shade was green glass. The bed was the hospital kind, and cranked up so she could almost sit. The lamp put her in a soft spotlight, with her hair loose on the shoulders of a pink dressing gown. Wireman sat beside her, holding her hands. Above her bed was the only painting in the room, a fine print of Edward Hopper's 11 a.m., an archetype of loneliness, waiting patiently at the window for some change, any change. Somewhere a clock was ticking. She looked at me and smiled. I saw three things in her face. They hit me one after the other like stones, each one heavier than the last. The first was how much weight she lost. The second was that she looked horribly tired. The third was that she hadn't long to live.
"Edward," she said.
"No," I began, but when she raised one hand, the flesh hanging down in a snow-white bag above her elbow, I stilled at once, because here was a fourth thing to see, and it hit hardest of all. Not a stone, but a boulder. I was looking at myself. This was what people had seen in the aftermath of my accident, when I was trying to sweep together the poor scattered bits of my memory. All that treasure that looked like trash when it was spread out in such ugly naked fashion. I thought of how I had forgotten my doll's name, and I knew what was coming next.
"I can do this," she said.
"I know you can," I said.
"You brought Wireman back from the hospital," she said.
"Yes."
"I was so afraid they'd keep him, and I would be alone."
I didn't reply to this.
"Are you Edmund?"
she asked timidly.
"Miss Eastlake, don't tax yourself,"
Wireman said gently.
"This is..."
"Hush, Wireman," I said. "She can do this."
"You paint," she said.
"Yes."
"Have you painted the ship yet?"
A curious thing happened to my stomach. It didn't sink so much as it seemed to disappear and leave a void between my heart and the rest of my guts. My knees tried to buckle. The steel in my hip went hot. The back of my neck went cold, and warm, prickling fire ran up the arm that wasn't there.
"Yes," I said, again and again and again. "You're Edgar," she said.
"Yes, Elizabeth, I'm Edgar. Good for you, honey." She smiled. I guess no one had called her honey in a long time.
"My mind is like a tablecloth with a great big hole burned into it."
She turned to Wireman.
"Muy divertido, see?"
"You need to rest," he said. "In fact, you need to dormir como un tronco." She smiled faintly.
"Like a log, yes. And I think when I wake up, I'll still be here. For a little while."
She lifted his hands to her face and kissed them.
"I love you, Wireman."
"I love you too, Miss Eastlake," he said. Good for him.
"Edgar? Is it Edgar?"
"What do you think, Elizabeth?"
"Yes, of course it is. You're to have a show. Is that how we left things before my last?
She drooped her eyelids as if to mime sleep.
Yes, at the Scotto Gallery. You really need to rest. Is it soon, your show?
In less than a week.
Your paintings, the ship paintings, are they on the mainland, at the gallery?
Wireman and I exchanged a look. He shrugged.
Yes, I said.
Good. She smiled. I'll rest then. Everything else can wait. Until after you have your show.
Your moment in the sun. Are you selling them? The ship pictures?
Wireman and I exchanged another look, and the message in his eyes was very clear. Don't upset her. They're marked NFS, Elizabeth. That means...
I know what it means, Edgar. I didn't fall out of an orange tree yesterday.
Inside their deep pockets of wrinkles, caught in a face that was receding toward death, her eyes flashed.
Sell them. However many there are, you must sell them. And however hard it is for you, break them up. Send them to the four winds. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Will you do it?
I didn't know if I would or not, but I recognized her signs of growing agitation from my own not-so-distant past. Yes. At that point, I would have promised her to jump to the moon in 7-league boots, if it would have eased her mind.
Even then, they may not be safe,
she mused in an almost horrified voice. Stop now, I said, and patted her hand. Stop thinking about this.
All right, we'll talk more after your show. The three of us. I'll be stronger, clearer, and you, Edgar, will be able to pay attention. Do you have daughters? I seem to remember that you do.
Yes, and they're staying on the mainland with their mother at the Ritz. That's already arranged. She smiled, but the corners drooped almost at once. It was as if her mouth were melting.
Crank me down, Wyman. I've been in the swamp 40 days and 40 nights. So it feels, and I'm tired.
He cranked her down, and Anne-Marie came in with something in a glass on a tray. No chance Elizabeth was going to drink any of it. She had already corked off. Over her head, the loneliest girl in the world sat in a chair and looked out the window forever, face hidden by the fall of her hair, naked but for a pair of shoes. 10. For me, sleep was long in coming that night. It was after midnight before I finally slipped away. The tide had withdrawn, and the whispered conversation under the house had ceased. That didn't stop the whispered voices in my head, however. Another Florida, Mary Iyer whispered. That was another Florida. Sell them. However many there are, you must sell them. That was Elizabeth, of course. The grown Elizabeth. I heard another version of her, however. And because I had to make this voice up, what I heard was Ilse's voice, as it had been as a child.
There's treasure, Daddy, this voice said. You can get it if you put on your mask and snorkel. I can show you where to look. I drew a picture.
11. I was up with the dawn. I thought I could go to sleep again, but not until I took one of the few OxyContin pills I still had put aside. And until I made a telephone call. I took the pill, then dialed the Scotto and got the answering machine. There wouldn't be a living person in the gallery for hours yet. Artistic types aren't morning people. I pushed 11 for Dario Nannuzzi's extension, and after the beep I said, Dario, it's Edgar. I've changed my mind about the Girl and Ship series. I want to sell them after all, okay? The only caveat is that they should all go to different people, if possible. Thanks. I hung up and went back to bed. Lay there for 15 minutes watching the overhead fan turn lazily and listening to the shells whisper beneath me. The pill was working, but I wasn't drifting off. And I knew why. I knew exactly why. I got up again, hit redial, listened to the recorded message, then punched in Dario's extension one more time.
His recorded voice invited me to leave a message at the beep. "Except for number 8, I said. "That one is still NFS." And why was it NFS? Not because it was genius, although I think it was. Not even because when I looked at it, it was, for me, like listening to the darkest part of my heart telling its tale. It was because I felt that something had let me live just to paint it, and that to sell it would be to deny my own life and all the pain I had undergone to reclaim it. Yeah, that. That one's mine, Dario, I said. Then I went back to bed, and that time I slept. How to draw a picture. 7. Remember that seeing is believing, puts the cart before the horse. Art is the concrete artifact of faith and expectation, the realization of a world that would otherwise be little more than a veil of pointless consciousness stretched over a gulf of mystery. And besides, if you don't believe what you see, who will believe your art? The trouble after the treasure all had to do with belief. Elizabeth was fiercely talented, but she was only a child. And with children, faith is a given. It's part of the standard equipment. Nor are children, even the talented ones, especially the talented ones, in full possession of their faculties. Their reason still sleeps, and the sleep of reason breeds monsters. Here's a picture I never painted. Identical twins in identical jumpers, except one is red, with an L on the front, and the other is blue, with a T. The girls are holding hands as they run along the path that leads to Shade Beach. They call it that because for most of the day, it's in the shadow of Hag's Rock. There are tear tracks on their pale, round faces, but they will soon be gone because by now they are too terrorized to cry. If you can believe this, you can see the rest. A giant crow flies slowly past them, upside down, its wings outstretched. It speaks to them in their daddy's voice. Lolo falls and cuts her knees on the shells. Tessie pulls her to her feet. They run on. It isn't the upside-down talking crow they're afraid of, nor the way the sky sometimes lenses from blue to a sunset red before going back to blue. It is the thing behind them, the big boy. Even with its fangs, it still looks a little like one of the funny frogs Livet used to draw. But this one is ever so much bigger and real enough to cast a shadow, real enough to stink and shake the ground each time it jumps. They have been frightened by all sorts of things since Daddy found the treasure, and Libet says they dasn't come out of their room at night, or even look out of their windows. But this is day, and the thing behind them is too real not to be believed, and it is gaining. The next time it's Tessie who falls and Lolo who pulls her up, casting a terrified glance behind her at the thing chasing them. It's surrounded by dancing bugs it sometimes licks out of the air. Lolo can see Tessie in one bulging, stupid eye. She herself is in the other. They burst onto the beach, gasping and out of breath, and now there's nowhere to go but the water. Except maybe there is because the boat is back again, the one they have seen more and more frequently in the last few weeks. Livet says the boat isn't what it seems, but now it's a floating white dream of safety, and besides, there is no choice. The big boy is almost at their heels. It came out of the swimming pool just after they finished playing Addie's wedding in Rampopo, the baby house on the side lawn. Today Lolo got to play Addie. Sometimes Libet can make these awful things go away by scribbling on her pad, but now Libet is sleeping. She has had a great many troubled nights lately. The big boy leaps off the path and onto the beach, spraying sand all around. Its bulging eyes stare. Its fragile white belly so full of noisome guts bulges. Its throat throbs. The two girls, standing with their hands linked and their feet in the running boil of what Daddy calls the little surf, look at each other. Then they look at the ship, swinging at anchor with its sails furled and shining. It looks even closer, as if it has moved in to rescue them. Lolo says, "We have to." Tessie says, "But I can't swim." "You can dog paddle." The big boy leaps. They can hear its guts slosh when it lands. They sound like wet garbage in a barrel of water. The blue fades from the sky, and then the sky bleeds red. Then slowly it changes back again.
It's been that kind of day. And haven't they known this kind of day was coming? Haven't they seen it in Libet's haunted eyes? Nan Melda knows, even Daddy knows. And he's not here all the time. Today he's in Tampa. And when they look at the greenish-white horror that's almost upon them, they know that Tampa might as well be the far side of the moon. They are on their own. Tessie grips Lolo's shoulder with cold fingers. What about the rip? But Lolo shakes her head. The rip is good. The rip will take us to the boat. There's no more time to talk. The frog thing is getting ready to leap again, and they understand that, while it cannot be real, somehow it is. It can kill them. Better to chance the water. They turn, still holding hands, and throw themselves into the caldo. They fix their eyes on the slim white swallow, swinging at anchor close to them. Surely they will be hauled aboard, and someone will use the ship to shore to call the roost. Netted us a pair of mermaids, they'll say. You know anyone who wants them? The rip parts their hands. It is ruthless, and Lolo actually drowns first because she fights harder. Tessie hears her cry out twice, first for help, then giving up her sister's name. Meanwhile, a vagary of the rip is sweeping Tessie straight for the ship and holding her up at the same time. For a few magical moments, it's as though she's on a surfboard, and her weak dog paddle seems to be propelling her like an outboard motor. Then, just before a colder current reaches up and coils around her ankles, she sees the ship change into... Here's a picture I did paint, not once, but again and again and again. The whiteness of the hull doesn't exactly disappear. It is sucked inward like blood fleeing the cheek of a terrified man. The ropes fray. The bright work dulls. The glass in the windows of the aft cabin bursts outward. A junk heap clutter appears on the decking, rolling into existence from fore to aft. Except it was there all along. Tessie just didn't see it. Now she sees. Now she believes. A creature comes from below decks. It creeps to the railing, where it stares down at the girl. It is a slumped thing in a hooded red robe. Hair that might not be hair at all flutters dankly around a melted face. Yellow hands grip splintered punky wood, then one lifts slowly and waves to the girl, who will soon be gone. It says, "Come to me, child." And drowning, Tessie Eastlake thinks, it's a woman. She sinks, and does she feel still warm hands, those of her freshly dead sister gripping her calves and pulling her down? Yes, of course. Of course she does. Believing is also feeling. Any artist will tell you so. 13. The Show. 1. Someday, if your life is long and your thinking machinery stays in gear, you'll live to remember the last good thing that ever happened to you. That's not pessimism talking, just logic. I hope I haven't run out of good things yet. There would be no purpose in living if I believed I had. But it's been a long time between. I remember the last one, clearly. It happened a little over 4 years ago, on the evening of April 15th, at the Scotto Gallery. It was between 7:45 and 8 o'clock, and the shadows on Palm Avenue were beginning to take on the first faint tinges of blue. I know the time because I kept checking my watch. The Scotto was already packed, to the legal limit and probably a little beyond, but my family hadn't arrived. I'd seen Pam and Illy earlier in the day, and Wireman had assured me that Melinda's flight was on time. But so far that evening, there hadn't been a sign of them, or a call. In the alcove to my left, where both the bar and 8 of the Sunset With pictures had drawn a crowd, a trio from the local music conservatory was tinkling through a funereal version of My Funny Valentine. Mary Iyer, holding a glass of champagne, but sober so far, was expatiating on something artistic to an attentive little crowd. To the right was a bigger room featuring a buffet. On one wall in there was Roses Grow from Shells and a painting called I See the Moon. On another, 3 views of Duma Road. I'd observed several people taking photographs of these with their camera phones, although a sign on a tripod just inside the door announced that all photography was verboten. I mentioned this to Jimmy Yoshida in passing, and he nodded, seeming not angry or even irritated, but rather bemused. There are a great many people here I either don't associate with the art scene or don't recognize at all, he said. The size of this crowd is outside my experience.
Is that a bad thing?
God, no. But after years of fighting to keep our corporate heads above water, it feels strange to be carried along this way. The Skoto Center Gallery was large, which was a good thing that night. In spite of the food, drink, and music in the smaller rooms, the center seemed to be where most of the visitors eventually gravitated. The Girl and Ship series had been mounted there on almost invisible cords, directly down the center of the room. Wireman Looks West was on the wall at the far end. That one and Girl and Ship Number 8 were the only paintings in the show which I had stickered NFS, Wireman because the painting was his, and Number 8 because I simply couldn't sell it.
"We keeping you up, boss?"
Angel Slobotnik said from my left, as oblivious to his wife's elbow as ever.
"No," I said. "I was never more awake in my life. I just..."
A man in a suit that had to have cost $2,000 stuck out his hand.
"Henry Vestic, Mr. Fremantle, First Sarasota Bank and Trust, private accounts. These are just marvelous. I'm stunned. I am amazed."
"Thank you," I said, thinking he'd left out, "You must not stop." "Very kind." A business card appeared between his fingers. It was like watching a street busker do a magic trick, or would have been if street buskers wore Armani suits. "If there's anything I can do, I've written my phone numbers on the back, home, cell, office."
"Very kind," I repeated.
I couldn't think of anything else to say, and really, what did Mr. Vestic think I was going to do? Call him at home and thank him again? Ask him for a loan and offer him a painting as collateral?
"May I bring my wife over later and introduce her?"
he asked, and I saw a look in his eyes. It wasn't exactly like the look that had been in Wireman's when he realized that I'd put the blocks to Candy Brown, but it was close, as if Vestic were a little afraid of me. "Of course," I said, and he slipped away.
"You used to build banks for guys like that and then have to fight them when they didn't want to pay the overage,"
Angel said. He was in a blue off-the-rack suit and looked on the verge of bursting out of it in 9 different directions, like the Incredible Hulk. "Back then he would have thought you were just some moke trying to mess up his day. Now he looks at you like you could shit gold belt buckles."
"Angel, you stop,"
Helen Slobotnik cried, simultaneously throwing another elbow and grabbing for a glass of champagne. He held it serenely out of her reach.
"Tell her it's the truth, boss."
"I think it sort of is," I said. And it wasn't only the banker I was getting that look from. The women, geez. When my eyes met theirs, I caught a softening, a speculation, as if they were wondering how I might hold them with only one arm. That was probably crazy, but... I was grabbed from behind, almost yanked off my feet. My own glass of champagne would have spilled, but Angel snatched it deftly. I turned, and there was Kathy Green smiling at me. She had left the rehab Gestapo far behind, at least for tonight. She was wearing a short, shimmery green dress that clung to every well-maintained inch of her, and in her heels she stood almost to my forehead. Standing beside her, towering over her, was Cayman. His enormous eyes swam benevolently behind his horn-rimmed glasses.
"Jesus, Kathy," I cried. "What would you have done if you'd knocked me over?"
"Made you give me 50?
She said, smiling more widely than ever. Her eyes were full of tears.
"Told you that on the phone. Look at your tan, you handsome boy."
The tears spilled over and she hugged me. I hugged back, then shook hands with Cayman. His hand swallowed mine whole.
"Your plane is the way for men my size to fly," he said,
and people turned in his direction. He had one of those deep James Earl Jones voices that can make supermarket circulars sound like the Book of Isaiah.
"I enjoyed myself to the max, Edgar."
"It's not really mine, but thank you," I said. "Have either of you..."
"Mr. Fremantle?"
There was a lovely redhead whose generously freckled breasts were in danger of tumbling from the top of a fragile pink dress. She had big green eyes. She looked about my daughter Melinda's age. Before I could say anything, she reached out and gently grasped my fingers.
"I just wanted to touch the hand that painted those pictures," she said. "Those wonderful, freaky pictures. God, you're amazing."
She lifted my hand and kissed it. Then she pressed it to one of her breasts. I could feel the rough pebble of nipple through a thin gauze of chiffon. Then she was gone into the crowd.
"Does that happen often?"
Cayman asked. And at the same moment, Kathy asked,
"So how's the divorce treating you, Edgar?"
They looked at each other for a moment, then burst out laughing.
I understood what they were laughing at, Edgar's Elvis moment. But to me it just seemed weird. The rooms of the Scoto began to look a little like chambers in an undersea grotto, and I realized I could paint it that way. Undersea rooms with paintings on their walls, paintings that were being looked at by schooling peoplefish while Neptune's trio burbled Octopus's Garden. Far too weird. I wanted Wireman and Jack, also not here yet. But even more, I wanted my people, Illy most of all. If I had them, maybe this would start to feel like reality again. I glanced toward the door.
"If you're looking for Pam and the girls, I expect they'll be right along," Cayman said.
Melinda had a problem with her dress and went up to change it at the last minute.
Melinda, I thought, of course, it would be Mel. And that was when I saw them, threading their way through the crowd of artistic gawkers, looking very northern and out of place amid the tans. Tom Riley and William Bozeman III, the immortal Bozy, paced behind them in dark suits. They stopped to look at three of the early sketches, which Dario had set up near the door in a triptych. It was Ilsa who saw me first. She cried, "Daddy!" and then cut through the crowd like a PT boat with her sister just behind her. Lynn was tugging a tall young man in her wake. Pam waved and also started toward me. I left Cayman, Kathy, and the Slobotniks, Angel still holding my drink. Someone began, "Pardon me, Mr. Fremantle, I wonder if I could ask..." But I paid no attention. In that moment, all I could see was Ilsa's glowing face and joyous eyes. We met in front of the sign reading, "The Scoto Gallery presents The View from Duma, Paintings and Sketches by Edgar Fremantle." I was aware that she was wearing a powder blue dress I had never seen before, and that with her hair up and what seemed like a swan's length of neck showing, she looked startlingly adult. I was aware of an immense, almost overpowering love for her, and gratitude that she felt the same for me. It was in her eyes. Then I was holding her. A moment later, Melinda was there with her young man standing beside her, and above her, he was one long, tall helicopter. I didn't have an arm for her and her sister both, but she had one for me. She grabbed me and kissed the side of my face. "Bonsoir, Dad. Congratulations." Then Pam was in front of me, the woman I had called a quitting birch not so long ago. She was wearing a dark blue pantsuit, a light blue silk blouse, and a string of pearls, sensible earrings, sensible but good-looking low heels. Full Minnesota, if I had ever seen it. She was obviously frightened to death by all the people in the strange environment, but there was a hopeful smile on her face just the same. Pam had been many things in the course of our marriage, but hopeless was never one of them.
"Edgar?" Pam asked in a small voice. "Are we still friends?"
"You better believe it," I said.
I only kissed her briefly, but hugged her as thoroughly as a one-armed man can do it. Ilsa was holding on to me on one side. Melinda had the other, squeezing hard enough to hurt my ribs, but I didn't care. As if from a great distance, I heard the room erupt in spontaneous applause.
"You look good," Pam whispered in my ear. "No, you look wonderful. I'm not sure I would have known you on the street." I stepped back a little, looking at her. "You look pretty fine yourself." She laughed, blushing, a stranger with whom I had once spent my nights. "Makeup covers a multitude of sins."
"Daddy, this is Rick Dussault," Melinda said. "Bonsoir and congratulations, Monsieur Fremantle," Rick said. He was holding a plain white box. He now held it out. "From Linny and me, un cadeau."
"The gift?"
I knew what un cadeau was, of course.
The real revelation was the exotic lilt his accent gave to my daughter's nickname. It made me understand, in a way nothing else could, that she was now more his than mine. It seemed to me that the majority of the people in the gallery had gathered around to watch me open my present. Tom Riley had made it almost to Pam's shoulder. Bosey was next to him. From just behind them, Margaret Bozeman skated me a kiss from the heel of her palm. Next to her was Todd Jameson, the doctor who had saved my life. Two sets of aunts and uncles. Rudy Rudnick, my old secretary. Kamen, of course. He was impossible to miss. And Kathy by his side. They had all come. Everyone but Wireman and Jack. And I was beginning to wonder if something had happened to keep them away. But for the moment, that seemed secondary. I thought of waking up in my hospital bed, confused and separated from everything, by unremitting pain. Then I looked around at this, and wondered how things could possibly have changed so completely. All these people had come back into my life for one night. I didn't want to cry, but I was pretty sure I was going to. I could feel myself starting to dissolve like a tissue in a cloudburst.
"Open it, Daddy," Ilsa said.
I could smell her perfume, something sweet and fresh.
"Open it! Open it!"
Good-natured voices from the packed circle watching us. I opened the box, pulled out some white tissue paper, and uncovered what I had expected. Although I had expected something jokey, and this was no joke. The beret Melinda and Rick had brought me from France was dark red velvet and smooth as silk to the touch. It had not come cheap.
"This is too nice," I said.
"No, Daddy," Melinda said, "not nice enough. We only hope it fits." I took it out of the box and held it up. The audience oohed appreciatively. Melinda and Rick looked at each other happily, and Pam, who felt Lynn somehow never got her proper share of affection or approval from me, and she was probably right, gave me a look that was positively radiant. Then I put the beret on. It was a perfect fit. Melinda reached up, made one tiny adjustment, faced the watching audience, turned her palms outward to me and said,
"Voici mon père, ce magnifique artiste."
They burst into applause and cries of "Bravo!" Ilsa kissed me. She was crying and laughing. I remember the white vulnerability of her neck and the feel of her lips just above my jaw. I was the belle of the ball, and I had my family around me. There was light and champagne and music. It happened 4 years ago, on the evening of April 15th, between 7:45 and 8 o'clock, while the shadows on Palm Avenue were just beginning to take on the first faint tinges of blue. This is a memory I keep. 2. I toured them around, with Tom and Bosey and the rest of the Minnesota crowd tagging after. Many of those present might have been first-time gallery attendees, but they were polite enough to give us some space. Melinda paused for a full minute in front of Sunset with Sephora, then turned to me, almost accusingly. "If you could do this all along, Dad, why in God's name did you waste 30 years of your life putting up county extension buildings?" "Melinda Jean," Pam said, but absently. She was looking toward the center of the room where the girl and ship paintings hung suspended. "Well, it's true," Melinda said, "isn't it?"
"Honey, I didn't know."
"How can you have something this big inside you and not know?" she demanded. I didn't have an answer for that, but Alice O'Coin rescued me.
"Edgar, Dario wondered if you could step into Jimmy's office for a few minutes. I'll be happy to escort your family into the main room and you can join them there."
"Okay. What do they want?"
"Don't worry, they're all smiling," she said, and smiled herself.
"Go on, Edgar," Pam said. And to Alice, "I'm used to him being called away. When we were married, it was a way of life."
"Dad, what does this red circle on the top of the frame mean?" Ilsa asked.
"That it's sold, dear," Alice said. I paused to look at Sunset with Sephora as I started away, and, sure enough, there was a little red circle on the upper right corner of the frame. That was a good thing. It was nice to know the crowd here was composed of more than just lookers drawn by the novelty of a one-armed dauber. But I still felt a pang and wondered if it was normal to feel that way. I had no way of telling. I didn't know any other artists to ask.
3. Dario and Jimmy Yoshida were in the office. So was a man I'd never met before. Dario introduced him to me as Jacob Rosenblatt, the accountant who kept the Scotto's books in trim. My heart sank a little as I shook his hand, turning my own to do it because he offered the wrong one, as so many people do. Ah, but it's a righty's world. "Dario, are we in trouble here?" I asked. Dario placed a silver champagne bucket on Jimmy's desk. In it, reclining on a bed of crushed ice, was a bottle of Perrier Jouet. The stuff they were serving in the gallery was good, but not this good. The cork had been recently drawn. There was still faint breath drifting from the bottle's green mouth.
"Does this look like trouble?"
he asked.
"I would have had Alice ask your family in as well, but the office is too freaking small. Two people who should be here right now are Wireman and Jack Cantori. Where the hell are they? I thought they were coming together."
"So did I. Did you try Elizabeth Eastlake's house? Heron's Roost?"
"Of course," Dario said. "Got nothing but the answering machine."
"Not even Elizabeth's nurse? Anne-Marie?" He shook his head.
"Just the answering machine."
I started having visions of Sarasota Memorial. I don't like the sound of that. "Perhaps the three of them are on their way here right now," Rosenblatt said. "I think that's unlikely. She's gotten very frail and short of breath. Can't even use her walker anymore." "I'm sure the situation will resolve itself," Jimmy said. "Meanwhile, we should raise a glass."
"Must raise a glass, Edgar,"
Dario added. "Thanks, you guys. That's very kind, and I'd be happy to have a drink with you, but my family's outside, and I want to walk around with them while they look at the rest of my pictures, if that's all right." Jimmy said,
"Understandable, but..."
Dario interrupted, speaking quietly.
"Edgar, the show's a sell."
I looked at him.
"Beg your pardon?"
"We didn't think you'd had a chance to get around and see all the red dots," Jimmy said. He was smiling, his color so high he might have been blushing.
"Every painting and sketch that was for sale has been sold."
Jacob Rosenblatt, the accountant, said, 30 paintings and 14 sketches, it's unheard of." "But..." My lips felt numb. I watched as Dario turned, and this time took a tray of glasses from the shelf behind the desk. They were in the same floral pattern as the Perrier Jouet bottle. "But the price you put on girl in ship number 7 was $40,000. From the pocket of his plain black suit, Rosenblatt took a curl of paper that had to have come from an adding machine. "The paintings fetched $487,000, the sketches an additional $19,000. The total comes to a little over $500,000. It's the greatest sum the Scotto has ever taken in during the exhibition of a single artist's work. An amazing coup. Congratulations."
"All of them?"
I said in a voice so tiny I could hardly hear it myself. I looked at Dario as he put a champagne glass in my hand. He nodded.
"If you had decided to sell girl and ship number 8, I believe that one alone would have fetched $100,000.
"Twice that," Jimmy said. "To Edgar Freemantle, at the start of his brilliant career," Rosenblatt said and raised his glass. We raised our glasses and drank, not knowing that my brilliant career was, for all practical purposes, at an end. We caught a break there, muchacho.
4. Tom Riley fell in beside me as I moved back through the crowd toward my family, smiling and shaking conversational gambits as fast as I could.
"Boss, these are incredible," he said. "But they're a little spooky, too."
"I guess that's a compliment," I said.
The truth was, talking to Tom felt spooky, knowing what I did about him.
"It's definitely a compliment," he said. "Listen, you're headed for your family. I'll take a hike." And he started to do just that, but I grabbed him by the elbow.
"Stick with me," I said. "Together we can repel all borders. On my own, I may not get to Pam and the girls until 9 o'clock. He laughed. Old Tommy looked good. He'd added some pounds since that day at Lake Phelan,
but I'd read that antidepressants sometimes do that, especially to men. On him, a little more weight was okay. The hollows under his eyes had filled in. How have you been, Tom?
Well, in truth, depressed.
He lifted one hand in the air as if to wave off a commiseration I hadn't offered. It's a chemical imbalance thing, and it's a bitch getting used to the pills. They muddy up your thinking at first. They did mine, anyway. I went off them a while, but I'm back on now, and life's looking better. It's either the fake endorphins kicking in or the effect of springtime in the land of a billion lakes. And the Fremantle Company? The books are in the black, but it's not the same without you. I came down here thinking I might pitch you on coming back. Then I got a look at what you're doing, and I realized your days in the building biz are probably done.
I think so, yeah.
He gestured toward the canvases in the main room.
What are they, really? I mean, no bullshit, because I wouldn't say this to very many people. They remind me of the way life was inside my head when I wasn't taking my pills.
They're just make-believe, I said. Shadows.
I know about shadows, he said.
You just want to be careful they don't grow teeth, because they can. Then, sometimes when you reach for the light switch to make them go away, you discover the power's out.
But you're better now.
Yes, he said. Pam had a lot to do with that. Can I tell you something about her you might already know?
Sure, I said, only hoping he wasn't going to share the fact that she sometimes laughed way down in her throat when she came.
She has great insight, but little kindness, Tom said. It's a weirdly cruel mix.
I said nothing, but not necessarily because I thought he was wrong.
She gave me a brisk talking to about taking care of myself not so long ago, and it hit home.
Yeah?
Yeah. And from the look of her, you might be in for talking to yourself, Edgar. I think I might find your friend Cayman and engage him in a bit of discourse. Excuse me.
The girls and Rick were staring up at Wireman Looks West and chattering animatedly. Pam, however, was positioned about halfway down the line of girl and ship paintings, which hung like movie posters, and she looked disturbed. Not angry, exactly, just disturbed, confused. She beckoned me over, and once I was there, she didn't waste time.
Is the little girl in these pictures Ilsa? She pointed up at number one. I thought at first this one with the red hair was supposed to be the doll Dr. Cayman gave you after your accident, but Ilsa had a tic-tac-toe dress like that when she was little. I bought it at Romper's. And this one... Now she pointed at number three. I swear this is the dress she just had to have to start first grade in. The one she was wearing when she broke her damn arm that night after the stock car races.
Well, there you were. I remembered the broken arm as having come after church, but that was only a minor misstep in the grand dance of memory. There were more important things. One was that Pam was in a unique position to see through most of the smoke and mirrors that critics like to call art. At least in my case, she was. In that way, and probably in a great many others, she was still my wife. It seemed that in the end, only time could issue a divorce decree, and that the decree would be partial at best. I turned her toward me. We were being watched by a great many people, and I suppose to them it looked like an embrace. And in a way it was. I got one glimpse of her wide, startled eyes, and then I was whispering in her ear, "Yes, the girl in the rowboat is Ilsa. I never meant her to be there, because I never meant anything. I never even knew I was going to paint these pictures until I started doing them. And because she's back, too, no one else is ever going to know unless you or I tell them, and I won't, but..." I pulled back. Her eyes were still wide, her lips parted as if to receive a kiss.
What did Ilsa say?
The oddest thing.
She took me by the sleeve and pulled me down to number 7 and number 8. In both of these, Rowboat Girl was wearing the green dress with straps that crossed over her bare back. She said you must be reading her mind because she ordered a dress like that from Newport News just this spring. She looked back at the pictures. I stood silently beside her and let her look.
I don't like these, Edgar. They're not like the others, and I don't like them.
I thought of Tom Riley saying, "Your ex has great insight, but little kindness."
Pam lowered her voice. You don't know something about Illy that you shouldn't, do you? The way you knew about... No, I said. But I was more troubled by the girl and ship series than ever. Some of it was seeing them all hung in a line. The accumulated weirdness was like a punch. Sell them. That was Elizabeth's opinion. However many there are, you must sell them. And I could understand why she thought so. I did not like seeing my daughter, not even in the guise of the child she had long outgrown, in such close proximity to that rotted She-Hulk. And in a way, I was surprised that perplexity and disquiet were all Pam felt. But of course, the paintings hadn't had a chance to work on her yet. And they were no longer on Duma Key. The young people joined us, Rick and Melinda, with their arms round each other. Daddy, you're a genius, Melinda said. Rick thinks so too, don't you, Rick? Actually, Rick said, I do. I came prepared to be polite. Instead, I am struggling for the words to say I am amazed. That's very kind, I said. Merci. I'm so proud of you, Dad, Illy said and hugged me. Pam rolled her eyes, and in that instant I could cheerfully have whacked her one. Instead, I folded Ilsa into my arms and kissed the top of her head. As I did, Mary Iyer's voice rose from the front of the Skoda in a cigarette-hoarsened shout that was full of amazed disbelief. Libby Eastlake, I don't believe my goddamned eyes. It was my ears I didn't believe, but when a spontaneous spatter of applause erupted from the doorway, where the real aficionados had gathered to chat and take a little fresh evening air, I understood why Jack and Wireman had been late. 5. What? Pam asked. What? I had her on one side and Illy on the other as I moved toward the door. Linny and Rick bobbed along in our wake. The applause grew louder. People turned toward the door and craned to see. Who is it, Edgar? My best friends on the island. Then to Ilsa. One of them's the lady from down the road, remember her? She turned out to be the daughter of the godfather instead of the bride. Her name's Elizabeth Eastlake, and she's a sweetheart. Ilsa's eyes were shining with excitement. The old gal in the big blue sneakers! The crowd, many of them still applauding, parted for us, and I saw the three of them in the reception area, where two tables with a punch bowl on each had been set up. My eyes began to sting and a lump rose in my throat. Jack was dressed in a slate-gray suit, with his usually unruly surfer's thatch tamed. He looked like either a junior executive in the Bank of America or an especially tall seventh grader on Careers Day. Wireman, pushing Elizabeth's chair, was wearing faded beltless jeans and a round-collared white linen shirt that emphasized his deep tan. His hair was combed back, and I realized for the first time that he was good-looking the way Harrison Ford was in his late 40s. But it was Elizabeth who stole the show. Elizabeth, who elicited the applause, even from the newbies who hadn't the slightest idea who she was. She was wearing a black pantsuit of dull rough cotton, loose but elegant. Her hair was up and held with a gauzy snood that flashed like diamonds beneath the gallery's downlighters. From her neck hung an ivory scrimshaw pendant on a gold chain, and on her feet were not big blue Frankenstein sneakers, but elegant pumps of darkest scarlet. Between the second and third fingers of her gnarled left hand was an unlit cigarette in a gold-chased holder. She looked left and right, smiling. When Mary came to the chair, Wireman stopped pushing long enough for the younger woman to kiss Elizabeth's cheek and whisper in her ear. Elizabeth listened, nodded, then whispered back. Mary cawed laughter, then caressed Elizabeth's arm. Someone brushed by me. It was Jacob Rosenblatt, the accountant. His eyes wet and his nose red. Dario and Jimmy were behind him. Rosenblatt knelt by her wheelchair, his bony knees cracking like starter pistols, and cried, Miss Eastlake, oh, Miss Eastlake, so long we're not seeing you, and now, oh, what a wonderful surprise. And you, Jake, she said, and cradled his bald head to her bosom. It looked like a very large egg laying there. Handsome as Bogart. She saw me and winked. I winked back, but it wasn't easy to keep my happy face on. She looked haggard, dreadfully tired in spite of her smile. I raised my eyes to Wireman's and he gave the tiniest of shrugs. She insisted, it said. I switched my gaze to Jack and got much the same. Rosenblatt, meanwhile, was rummaging in his pockets. At last, he came up with a book of matches so battered it looked as if it might have entered the United States without a passport at Ellis Island. He opened it and tore one out. "I thought smoking was against the rules in all these public buildings now," Elizabeth said. Rosenblatt struggled. Color rose up in his neck. I almost expected his head to explode. Finally, he exclaimed, "Fuck the rules, Miss Eastlake." "Bravissimo!" Mary shouted, laughing and throwing her hands to the ceiling, and at this there was another round of applause. A greater one came when Rosenblatt finally got the ancient match to ignite and held it out to Elizabeth, who placed her cigarette holder between her lips.
"Who is she really, Daddy?"
Ilsa asked softly. "Besides the little old lady who lives down the lane, I mean." I said, "According to reports, at one time she was the Sarasota art scene."
"I don't understand why that gives her the right to muck up our lungs with her cigarette smoke," Linny said. The vertical line was returning between her brows.
Rick smiled.
"Oh, Sherry.
This after all the bars we..."
"This is not there," she said, the vertical line deepening, and I thought, "Rick, you may be French, but you have a lot to learn about this particular American woman."
Alice O'Coin murmured to Dario, and from his pocket Dario produced an Altoids tin. He dumped the mints into the palm of his hand and gave Alice the tin. Alice gave it to Elizabeth, who thanked her and tapped her cigarette ash into it. Pam watched, fascinated, then turned to me. "What does she think of your pictures?"
"I don't know," I said. "She hasn't seen them."
Elizabeth was beckoning to me.
"Will you introduce me to your family, Edgar?"
I did, beginning with Pam and ending with Rick. Jack and Wireman also shook hands with Pam and the girls.
"After all the calls, I'm pleased to meet you in the flesh," Wireman told Pam.
"The same goes back to you," Pam said, sizing him up. She must have liked what she saw, because she smiled, and it was the real one, the one that lights her whole face. "We did it, didn't we? He didn't make it easy, but we did it."
"Art is never easy, young woman,"
Elizabeth said. Pam looked down at her, still smiling the genuine smile, the one I'd fallen in love with. "Do you know how long it's been since anyone called me young woman?"
But to me you look very young and beautiful," Elizabeth said.
And was this the woman who had been little more than a muttering lump of cheese slumped in her wheelchair only a week ago? Tonight that seemed hard to believe. Tired as she looked, it seemed impossible to believe.
"But not as young and beautiful as your daughters. Girls, your father is, by all accounts, a very talented fellow."
"We're very proud of him," Melinda said, twisting her necklace. Elizabeth smiled at her, then turned to me.
"I should like to see the work and judge for myself. Will you indulge me, Edgar?"
"I'd be happy to." I meant it, but I was damn nervous as well. Part of me was afraid to receive her opinion. That part was afraid she might shake her head and deliver her verdict with the bluntness to which her age entitled her.
"Facile, colorful, certainly lots of energy, but perhaps not up to much, in the end."
Wireman moved to grasp the handles of her chair, but she shook her head.
"No, let Edgar push me, Wireman. Let him tour me."
She plucked the half-smoked cigarette from the holder, those gnarled fingers doing the job with surprising dexterity, and crushed it out on the bottom of the tin.
"And the young lady's right. I think we've all had quite enough of this reek."
Melinda had the grace to blush. Elizabeth offered the tin to Rosenblatt, who took it with a smile and a nod. I have wondered since then, I know it's morbid, but yes, I've wondered, if she would have smoked more of it if she had known it was to be her last. 6. Even those who didn't know John Eastlake's surviving daughter from a hole in the wall understood that a personage had come among them. And the tidal flow
which had moved toward the reception area at the sound of Mary Iyer's exuberant shout, now reversed itself as I rolled the wheelchair into the alcove where most of the Sunset With pictures had been hung. Wireman and Pam walked on my left. Ilsa and Jack were on my right, Ilsa giving the wheelchair's handle on that side little helping taps to make sure it stayed on course. Melinda and Rick were behind us, Kamen, Tom Riley, and Bosie behind them. Behind that trio came seemingly everyone else in the gallery. I wasn't sure there would be room to get her chair in between the makeshift bar set up in the wall, but there was, just. I started to push it down that narrow aisle, grateful that we'd at least be leaving the rest of the retinue behind us, when Elizabeth cried, "Stop!" I stopped at once. "Elizabeth, are you all right?" "Just a minute, honey. Hush." We sat there looking at the paintings on the wall. After a little bit, she fetched a sigh and said, "Wyman, do you have a Kleenex?" He had a handkerchief, which he unfolded and handed to her. "Come round here, Edgar," she said. "Come where I can see you." I managed to get around between the wheelchair and the bar, with the bartender bracing the table to make sure it didn't tip over. "Are you able to kneel down so we can be face to face?" I was able. My great beach walks were paying dividends. She clutched her cigarette holder, both foolish and somehow magnificent, in one hand, Wireman's handkerchief in the other. Her eyes were damp. "You read me poems because Wyman couldn't. Do you remember that?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Of course I remembered. Those had been sweet interludes.
"If I were to say, speak memory to you, you'd think of the man, I can't recall his name, who wrote Lolita, wouldn't you?"
I had no idea who she was talking about, but I nodded.
"But there's a poem, too. I can't remember who wrote it, but it begins, speak memory that I may not forget the taste of roses, nor the sound of ashes in the wind, that I may once more taste the green cup of the sea. Does it move you?" "Yes, I see it does."
The hand with the cigarette holder in it opened. Then it reached out and caressed my hair. The idea occurred to me, and has since recurred, that all my struggle to live and regain a semblance of myself may have been paid back by no more than the touch of that old woman's hand, the eroded smoothness of the palm, the bent strength of those fingers.
"Art is memory, Edgar. There is no simpler way to say it. The clearer the memory, the better the art, the purer. These paintings, they break my heart and then make it new again. How glad I am to know they were done at Salmon Point, no matter what."
She lifted the hand she'd caressed my head with.
"Tell me what you call that one."
"Sunset with Sephora."
"And these are what? Sunset with Conch, numbers 1 through 4?
I smiled. "Well, there were 16 of them, actually, starting with colored pencil sketches. Some of those are out front. I picked the best oils for in here. They're surreal, I know, but..."
"They're not surreal. They're classical. Any fool can see that. They contain all the elements, earth, air, water, fire."
I saw Wireman mouth, "Don't tire her out." "Why don't I give you a quick tour of the rest, then get you a cold drink?" I asked her. And now Wireman was nodding and giving me a thumb and forefinger circle. "It's hot in here, even with the air conditioning."
"Fine," she said. "I am a little tired, but Edgar..."
"Yes."
"Save the ship paintings for the last. After them, I'll need a drink. Perhaps in the office. Just one, but something stiffer than Coca-Cola."
"You got it," I said, and edged my way back to the rear of the chair.
10 minutes,
Wireman whispered in my ear. "No more.
I'd want to get her out before Gene Hadlock shows up, if possible. He sees her, he's going to shit a brick. And you know who he'll throw it at."
10, I said, and rolled Elizabeth into the buffet room to look at the paintings in there. The crowd was still following. Mary Iyer had begun taking notes. Ilsa slipped one hand into the crook of my elbow and smiled at me. I smiled back, but I was having that I'm-in-a-dream feeling again, the kind that may tilt you into a nightmare at any moment. Elizabeth exclaimed over I See the Moon and the Duma Road series, but it was the way she reached her hand out to Roses Grow from Shells, as if to embrace it, that gave me goosebumps. She lowered her arms again and looked over her shoulder at me. "That's the essence of it," she said, "the essence of Duma. Why those who've lived there a while can never really leave. Even if their heads carry their bodies away, their hearts stay." She looked at the picture again and nodded. "Roses grow from shells. That is correct." "Thank you, Elizabeth." "No, Edgar. Thank you." I glanced back for Wireman and saw him talking to that other lawyer from my other life. They seemed to be getting along famously. I only hoped Wireman wouldn't slip and call him Bosey. Then I turned to Elizabeth again. She was still looking at Roses Grow from Shells and wiping her eyes. "I love this," she said, "but we should move along." After she'd seen the other paintings and sketches in the buffet room, she said, as if to herself, "Of course I knew someone would come, but I never would have guessed it would be someone who could produce works of such power and sweetness." Jack tapped me on the shoulder, then leaned close to murmur in my ear, "Dr. Hadlock has entered the building. Wireman wants you to speed this up if you can." The main gallery where the girl and ship paintings hung was on the way to the office, and Elizabeth could leave by the loading door and back after having her drink. It would actually be more convenient for her wheelchair. Hadlock could accompany her if he so desired. But I dreaded taking her past the ship series, and it was no longer her critical opinion I was worried about. "Come on," she said, and clicked her amethyst ring on the arm of her wheelchair. "Let's look at them. No hesitating." "All right," I said, and began pushing her toward the main gallery. "Are you all right, Eddie?" Pam asked in a low voice. "Fine," I said. "You're not. What's wrong?" I only shook my head. We were in the main room now. The pictures were suspended at a height of about 6 feet. The room was otherwise open. The walls, covered with coarse brown stuff that looked like burlap, were bare except for Wireman Looks West. I rolled Elizabeth's chair slowly along. The wheels were soundless on the pale blue carpet. The murmur of the crowd behind us had either stopped or my ears had filtered it out. I seemed to see the paintings for the first time, and they looked oddly like stills culled from a strip of movie film. Each image was a little clearer, a little more in focus, but always essentially the same, always the ship I had first glimpsed in a dream. It was always sunset, and the light filling the west was always a titanic red anvil that spread blood across the water and infected the sky. The ship was a three-masted corpse, something that had floated in from a plague house of the dead. Its sails were rags, its deck was deserted. There was something horrible in every angular line, and although it was impossible to say just what, you feared for the little girl alone in her rowboat. The little girl who first appeared in a tic-tac-toe dress. The little girl afloat on the wine-dark gulf. In that first version, the angle of the death ship was wrong to see anything of the name. In Girl and Ship Number 2, the angle had improved, but the little girl, still with the false red hair, and now also wearing Reba's polka-dotted dress, blocked out all but the letter P. In Number 3, P had become P-E-R, and Reba had pretty clearly become Ilsa, even back too. John Eastlake's spear pistol lay in the rowboat. If Elizabeth recognized this, she gave no indication. I pushed her slowly up the line as the ship bulked larger and closer, its black masts looming like fingers, its sails sagging. The furnace sky glared through the holes in the canvas. Now the name on the transom was Percy. There might have been more. There was room for more, but if so, it was hidden by the shadows. In Girl and Ship Number 6, the ship now looming over the rowboat, the little girl was wearing what appeared to be a blue singlet with a yellow stripe around the neck. Her hair in that one was orangish, It was the only rowboat girl whose identity I wasn't sure of. Maybe it was Ilsa, since the others were, but I wasn't entirely convinced. In this one, the first few rose petals had begun to appear on the water, plus one single yellow-green tennis ball with the letters D-U-N-L visible on it, and an odd assortment of gewgaws were heaped on deck. A tall mirror, which, reflecting the sunset, appeared filled with blood. A child's rocking horse, a steamer trunk, a pile of shoes. These same objects appeared in number 7 and number 8, where they had been joined by several others. A young girl's bicycle leaning against the foremast, a pile of tires stacked on the stern, a great hourglass at midships. This last also reflected the sun and appeared to be full of blood instead of sand. In girl and ship number 8, there were more rose petals floating between the rowboat and the Percy. There were more tennis balls, too, at least half a dozen, and a rotting garland of flowers hung around the neck of the rocking horse. I could almost smell the stench of their perfume on the still air. "Dear God," Elizabeth whispered, "she has grown so strong." There had been color in her face, but now it was all gone. She didn't look 85, she looked 200. "Who?" I tried to ask, but nothing came out. "Ma'am, Miss Eastlake, you shouldn't tax yourself," Pam said. I cleared my throat. "Can you get her a glass of water?" "I will, Dad," Illy said. Elizabeth was still staring at girl in ship number 8. "How many of those souvenirs do you recognize?" she asked.
"I don't. My imagination..."
I fell silent. The girl in the rowboat of number 8 was no souvenir, but she was Ilsa. The green dress with its bare back and crisscrossing straps had seemed jarringly sexy for a little girl, but now I knew why. It was a dress Ilsa had bought recently from a mail-order catalog, and Ilsa was no longer a little girl. Otherwise, the tennis balls were still a mystery to me. The mirror meant nothing, nor did the stack of tires, and I didn't know for a fact that the bicycle leaning against the foremast had been Tina Garibaldi's, but I feared it, and my heart was somehow sure of it. Elizabeth's hand, dreadfully cold, settled on my wrist. "There's no bullet on the frame of this last one." "I don't know what you're..." Her grip tightened. "You do. You know exactly what I mean. The show is a sell, Edgar. Do you think I'm blind? A bullet on the frame of every painting we looked at, including number 6, the one with my sister Addie in the rowboat. But not this one." I looked back toward number 6 where rowboat girl had orange hair. "That's your sister?" She paid no attention. I don't think she even heard me. All her attention was bent upon girl in ship number 8. "What do you mean to do? Take it back? Do you mean to take it back to Duma?" Her voice rang out in the quiet of the gallery. "Ma'am, Miss Eastlake, you really shouldn't excite yourself this way," Pam said. Elizabeth's eyes blazed in the hanging flesh of her face. Her nails dug into the scant meat of my wrist. "And what? Put it next to another one you've already started?" "I haven't started another." Or had I? My memory was playing me again, as it often did in moments of stress. If someone had at that moment demanded that I speak the name of my older daughter's French boyfriend, I probably would have said René, as in Magritte. The dream had tilted all right. Here was the nightmare, right on schedule. "The one where the rowboat is empty?" Before I could say anything, Jean Hadlock shoved through a crowd, followed by wiremen, followed by Ilsa holding a glass of water. "Elizabeth, we should go," Hadlock said. He reached for her arm. Elizabeth swept his hand away. On the follow-through, she struck the glass Ilsa was starting to proffer, and it went flying, hitting one of the bare walls and shattering. Someone cried out, and some woman incredibly laughed. "Do you see the rocking horse, Edgar?" She held out her hand. It was trembling badly. Her nails had been painted coral pink, probably by Anne-Marie.
"That belonged to my sisters, Tessie and Laura. They loved it. They dragged that damned thing with them everywhere.
It was outside Rampopo, the baby playhouse on the side lawn, after they drowned. My father couldn't bear to look at it. He had thrown it into the water at the memorial service, along with the garland, of course. The one around the horse's neck. Silence except for the tearing rasp of her breath. Mary and I are staring with big eyes, her obsessive note-taking at an end, the pad hanging forgotten in one hand by her side. Her other hand had gone to her mouth. Then Wireman pointed to a door that was quite cleverly concealed in more of the brown burlappy stuff. Hadlock nodded, and suddenly Jack was there, and it was actually Jack who took charge. "Have you out in a jiff, Miss Eastlake," he said. "No worries." He seized the handles of her wheelchair. "Look at the ship's wake," Elizabeth shouted at me as she was borne out of the public eye for the last time. "For Christ's sake, don't you see what you've painted?" I looked. So did my family. "There's nothing there," Melinda said. She looked mistrustfully toward the office door, which was just closing behind Jack and Elizabeth. "Is she dotty or what?" Illy was standing on tiptoe, craning for a closer look. "Daddy," she said hesitantly, "are those faces? Faces in the water?" "No," I said, surprised at the steadiness of my own voice. "All you're seeing is an idea she put in your head. Will you guys excuse me for a minute?" "Of course," Pam said.
"May I be of assistance, Edgar?" Cayman asked in his booming basso. I smiled. I was surprised at how easily that came too. Shock has its purposes, it seems. "Thanks, but no. Her doctor's in with her." I hurried toward the office door, resisting an urge to look back. Melinda hadn't seen it. Ilsa had. My guess was that not many people would, even if it were pointed out to them. And even then, most would dismiss it as either coincidence or a small artistic wink. Those faces. Those screaming, drowned faces in the ship's sunset wake. Tessie and Laura were there, most certainly, but others as well, just below them, where the red faded to green and the green to black. One might be a carrot-topped girl in an old-fashioned singlet-style bathing suit. Elizabeth's older sister, Adriana.
7. Wireman was giving her sips of what looked like Perrier while Rosenblatt fussed at her side, literally wringing his hands. The office seemed packed with people. It was hotter than the gallery, and getting hotter. "I want you all out," Hadlock said. "Everyone but Wireman. Now, right now." Elizabeth pushed aside the glass with the back of her hand. "Edgar," she said in a husky voice. "Edgar stays." "No, Edgar goes," Hadlock said. "You've excited yourself quite an—" His hand was in front of her. She seized it and squeezed it, with some force, it seemed, because Hadlock's eyes widened. "Stays." It was only a whisper, but a powerful one. People began to leave. I heard Dario telling the crowd gathered outside that everything was fine. Miss Eastlake felt a little faint, but her doctor was with her and she was recovering. Jack was going out the door when Elizabeth called, "Young man." He turned. "Don't forget," she told him. He gave her a brief grin and knocked off a salute. "No, ma'am, I sure won't."
"I should have trusted you in the first place," she said, and Jack went out.
Then, in a lower voice, as if her strength were fading,
"He's a good boy."
"Trusted him for what?" Wireman asked her.
"To search the attic for a certain picnic basket," she said. "In the picture on the landing, Nan Melda is holding it."
She looked at me reproachfully. "I'm sorry," I said. "I remember you telling me, but I got painting and—"
"I don't blame you," she said.
Her eyes had receded deep in their sockets.
"I should have known. It's her power. The same power that drew you here in the first place."
She looked at Wireman.
"And you."
"Elizabeth, that's enough," Hadlock said. "I want to take you to the hospital and run some tests, run some fluids into you while I'm at it, get you some rest."
"I'll be getting all the rest I need very soon now,"
she told him, and smiled. The smile exposed a large and rather gruesome ring of dentures. Her eyes returned to me.
"Trixie, Pixie, Nixie," she said. "To her it's all a game, all our sorrow, and she's awake again."
Her hand, very cold, settled on my forearm.
"Edgar, she's awake."
"Who? Elizabeth, who? Percy?" She shuddered backward in her chair. It was as if an electrical current were passing through her. The hand on my arm tightened. Her coral nails punched through my skin, leaving a quartet of red crescents. Her mouth opened, exposing her teeth this time in a snarl instead of a smile. Her head went backward, and I heard something in there snap.
"Catch the chair before it goes over,"
Wireman roared, but I couldn't. I had only one arm, and Elizabeth was clutching it, was docked in it. Hadlock grabbed one of the push handles, and the chair skittered sideways instead of toppling backwards. It struck Jimmy Yoshida's desk. Now Elizabeth was in full seizure mode, jittering back and forth in her chair like a puppet. The snood came loose from her hair and flailed, sparkling in the light of the overhead fluorescence. Her feet jerked, and one of her scarlet pumps went flying off. "The angels want to wear my red shoes," I thought. And as if the line had summoned it, blood burst from her nose and mouth.
"Hold her!"
Hadlock shouted, and Wireman threw himself across the arms of the chair. "She did this," I thought coldly. "Percy, whoever she is."
"I've got her," Wireman said. "Call 911, Doc, for Christ's sake."
Hadlock hurried around the desk, picked up the phone, dialed, listened.
"Fuck!
I just get more dial tone." I snatched it from him. "You must have to dial 9 for an outside line," I said, and did it with the phone cradled between my ear and shoulder. And when the calm-voiced woman on the other end asked me the nature of my emergency, I was able to tell her. It was the address I couldn't remember. I couldn't even remember the name of the gallery. I handed the phone to Hadlock and went back around the desk to Wireman. "Christ Jesus," he said. "I knew I shouldn't have brought her. I knew, but she was so fucking insistent." "Is she out?" I looked at her slumped in her chair. Her eyes were open, but they looked vacantly at a point in the far corner. "Elizabeth?" There was no response. "Was it a stroke?" Wireman asked. "I never knew they could be so violent." "That was no stroke. Something shut her up. Go to the hospital with her."
"Of course I'll go.
And if she says anything else, listen." Hadlock came back. "They're waiting for her at the hospital. An ambulance will be here any minute." He stared hard at Wireman. Then his look softened. "Oh, all right," he said. "Oh, all right," Wireman asked. "What does that mean, oh, all right?" "It means if something like this was going to happen," Hadlock said, "where do you think she would have wanted it to happen? At home in bed or in one of the galleries where she spent so many happy days and nights?" Wireman took in a deep, shaky breath, let it out, nodded, then knelt beside her and began to brush at her hair. Elizabeth's face was patchy red in places and bloated, as if she were having an extreme allergic reaction. Hadlock bent and tilted her head back, trying to ease her terrible rasping. Not long after, we heard the approaching warble of the ambulance. 8. The show dragged on and I stuck it out, partly because of all the effort Dario, Jimmy, and Alice had put into the thing, but mostly for Elizabeth. I thought it was what she would have wanted. My moment in the sun, she'd called it. I didn't go to the celebratory dinner afterwards, though. I made my excuses, then sent Pam and the girls on with Cayman, Kathy, and some of the others from Minneapolis. Watching them pull away, I realized I hadn't made arrangements for a ride to the hospital. While I was standing there in front of the gallery, wondering if Alice or Coyne had left yet, a beat-to-shit old Mercedes pulled up beside me, and the passenger window slid down. "Get in," Mary Iyer said. "If you're going to Sarasota Memorial, I'll drop you off." She saw me hesitate and smiled crookedly. "Mary's had very little to drink tonight, I assure you, and in any case, the Sarasota traffic goes from clogged to almost zero after 10 p.m.
The old folks take their scotch and Prozac and then curl up to watch Bill O'Reilly on TiVo. I got in. The door clunked when it shut, and for one alarming moment I thought my ass was going to keep descending until it was actually on Palm Avenue. Finally, my downward motion stopped. "Listen, Edgar," she said, then hesitated. "Can I still call you Edgar?" "Of course." She nodded. "Lovely." I couldn't remember with perfect clarity what sort of terms we parted on. Sometimes when I drink too much. She shrugged her bony shoulders. "We're fine," I said. "Good. As for Elizabeth, not so good, is it?" I shook my head, not trusting myself to speak. The streets were almost deserted, as promised. The sidewalks were dead empty. She and Jake Rosenblatt were a thing for a while. It was pretty serious. "What happened?" Mary shrugged. "Can't say for sure. If you forced me to guess, I'd say that in the end she was just too used to being her own mistress to be anyone else's. Other than on a part-time basis, that is. But Jake never got over her." I remembered him saying, "Fuck the rules, Miss Eastlake," and wondered what he had called her in bed. Surely not Miss Eastlake. It was a sad and useless bit of speculation. "Maybe this is for the best," Mary said. "She was guttering. If you'd known her in her prime, Edgar, you'd know she wasn't the sort of woman who'd want to go out that way." "I wish I had known her in her prime." "Can I do anything for your family?" "No," I said. "They're having dinner with Dario and Jimmy and the whole state of Minnesota. I'll join them later if I can, maybe for dessert. And I'm booked into the Ritz, where they're all staying. If nothing else, I'll see them in the morning." "That's nice." They seemed nice, and understanding. Pam actually seemed more understanding now than before the divorce. Of course, now I was down here painting and not up there yelling at her, or trying to staff her with a butterfife. "I'm going to praise your shows to the skies, Edgar. I doubt if that means much to you tonight, but perhaps it will later on. The paintings are just extraordinary." "Thank you." Ahead, the lights of the hospital were twinkling in the dark. There was a Waffle House right next door. It was probably good business for the cardiac unit. "Will you give Libby my love, if she's in any condition to take note of such things?"
"Sure."
"And I have something for you. It's in the glove compartment, manila envelope. I was going to use it to bait the hook for a follow-up interview, but fuck it. I had some problems with the old car's glove compartment button, but finally the little door fell open like a corpse's mouth. There was a lot more than a manila envelope in there. A geologist could have taken core samples, probably going back to 1965, but the envelope was in front and it had my name printed on it. As she pulled up in front of the hospital in a spot marked 5 minutes pick-up and drop-off, Mary said, "Prepare to be amazed. I was. An old copy editor friend of mine chased that down for me. She's older than Libby, but still sharp." I bent back the clasps and slid out two Xeroxed sheets of an ancient newspaper story. "That," Mary said, "is from the Port Charlotte Weekly Echo, June of 1925. It's got to be the story my friend Aggie saw. And the reason I could never find it is because I never looked as far south as Port Charlotte. Also, the Weekly Echo gave up the ghost in 1931. The streetlight beneath which she'd parked wasn't good enough for the fine print, but I could read the headline and see the picture. I looked for a long time. "It means something to you, doesn't it?" she asked.
"Yes. I just don't know what."
"If you figure it out, will you tell me?"
"All right," I said.
"You might even believe it.
But Mary, this is one story you'll never print. Thanks for the ride. And thanks for coming to my show.
Both my pleasure. Remember to give Libby my love."
"I will." But I never did. I had seen Elizabeth Eastlake for the last time.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Duma Key by Stephen King. Read by John Slattery.
Nine. The ICU nurse on duty told me that Elizabeth was in surgery. When I asked for what, she told me she wasn't sure. I looked around the waiting room. If you're looking for Mr. Wireman, I believe he went to the cafeteria for coffee, the nurse said. That's on the fourth floor. Thanks. I started away, then turned back. Is Dr. Hadlock part of the surgical team?
I don't think so, she said, but he's observing.
I thanked her again and went in search of Wireman. I found him in a far corner of the caf, sitting in front of a paper cup about the size of a World War II mortar shell.